always be careful. It's important to check all the sources. They might not be giving you the full picture, or they might have made, you know, an innocent mistake. So you need to be careful. Only use those sources that you trust. Are they likely to have accurate information on the story? How much checking do you need to do? Depends on the type of source, but it's usually a good idea to check the information with at least two different sources. That's our policy. So we have truth and accuracy, two of the BBC's basic news values. The audience need to trust you, and that depends on you being accurate. They're important values, and they'll help you become not just a reporter, but a trusted reporter. So good luck finding the new stories. Have fun, and we'll talk again.
So this is Bristol. The time is 11 minutes past 5 o'clock, and this is the Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 2nd of August 2024, streaming live from Eastone Studios. Sorry we're 10 minutes late tonight. I just had a few key problems getting into the building. Hopefully, after a few weeks of doing this, we'll iron out these problems. But anyway, we're here in Bristol, which, with London's Inner Temple, is one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies. Of course, what am I doing talking about medieval Templars? There's none of those around today. Of course, there are in the Second Crusade. Anyway, we're live on talkradio.org.uk. That's the stream. And at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. At DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, at radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex, and live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please use Aurora. I keep saying this, but please do it. You can delete, well, actually, disable, I think. They don't let you delete it, do they, Android? You can disable Google Play, which is an absolute joy, once you've downloaded the Aurora App Store. And it's got pretty much everything on there, and it works, I can guarantee, because I've just been installing things on my new phone from there. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators, and hatchet jobs on the heroes. One of the things that seems to be guaranteed is none of the real criminals are going to get an outing on the BBC or any of the major news networks. The McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the World War III and wage slavery. So meanwhile, wife murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie, which we'll be hearing about tonight, and Camilla wage war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS, through their latest glove puppet, with look what crawled out of the recycling bin, panda-eyed energy saboteur secretary Ed Miliband. So, helping us navigate the accelerationist WEF's Fourth Reich matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers here in the studio this week, rather than on a rather tinny phone connection, as he was last week, and also Bristol-based freelance journalist Joe Banks. This week we'll be looking at Rachel Reeves, inheritance tax, or owner tax, inheritance tax policing in Leeds, also at Manchester Airport, as well as the horrific events in Southport and the ramifications. We've got a demonstration taking place apparently by Tommy Robinson's group, and also a counter demonstration happening in Bristol. I'm sure the police are looking forward to that. Also, we'll be addressing some of these tensions over immigration in part two, assassinations as Netanyahu returns from the USA, and a prisoner swap, as well as Rockefeller and Bilderberg Trilateral Commission, a new interview I've discovered, actually it's from a few years ago, but all about the influence of the Rockefellers setting up these transnational organisations designed to steer the Western world particularly, and also bring in the West of the world, if possible, to a one world government. Iranian and Russian news cancelled in the UK by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom, and us cancelled off Bristol Community FM as well as PRSC by the trans lobby. But anyway, we're here now, and welcome to the studio, Joe. Nice to have you back. What do you think of our new venue?
It's very nice. I'm impressed. No, it's lovely. Yeah, well done for keeping on.
You're going to be talking a little bit about this new chief executive. Do you know what, before we go into the racism issue and the Southport issue, can you just give us a bit of a precursor of what you want to talk about?
Well, I just think, you know, I come and talk to you quite often about some of the things that are going on around the governance and local governance in Bristol and particularly planning and development, and these sort of these characters that move around from job to job, and some of these you know, institutions and quangos that doesn't really get much you know, coverage or scrutiny.
It's revolving doors we're talking about in a way, isn't it? Idea of the lobby suddenly becoming one of the civil servants or a top civil servant, even politicians, and then revolving back into industry again.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. I mean, so specifically, Bristol City Council has a new interim chief executive, who's the most senior officer running the council. And this is because the previous guy, Stephen Peacock, who I ran through his CV with you once before, and his background was actually at BP. He started off, he'd worked for a decade at BP and then been through the Southwest Regional Development Agency, the professional services company Grant Thornton, and then goes into local government. He was supposed to stay on beyond the end of the mayoral system, because we did have a mayor in Bristol that ended in May, and Peacock was meant to sort of be a steady hand on the tiller, staying to the end of the year, but instead he got a job at the West of England Combined Authority, which is this other sort of devolved layer that sits that Bristol City Council and some of the surrounding councils are part of, and then there's a separate West of England mayor who's Dan Norris, who's also now an MP, but that's another story. But anyway, Peacock's gone, so they need someone to come in, and they've hired this guy called Paul Martin, who you know, has an interesting CV that it's worth looking at, I think. Particularly, okay, in relation to his time, he was a decade at Wandsworth Council.
Anyway, we'll be talking about his background and how it relates to the way the city's run. One of the major influences the city still has, even though its budget is denuded, its public toilets mostly seem to be closed, is to do with the planning system. So we'll be hearing a bit about that from Joe after we've heard about the week's horrific events, from which everyone is calling horrific, which of course are horrific. Apparently Martin, a 17-year-old, walked into a dance class on Monday, stabbed three little girls to death, and then there was a counter demonstration. But well, I mean, how can we be in a country where this sort of thing happens? I mean, you can imagine maybe someone fanatic going and killing an MP, as happened to David Amos, also Joe Cox, so, you know, some sort of public figure. But it seems something's very, very wrong when you've got little kids like this being killed.
Well, obviously, we're still finding out what actually happened in terms of the motivation of the person involved. It looks as if
an alleged person at the moment needs to be charged,
yes,
so we're
right.
Not entirely sure.
Well, indeed.
And we haven't had a court case, but it does look likely that it was this guy that the police have got.
Well, as far as we can tell at this stage, there doesn't seem to be any rational motivation for it at all. It's just bad behaviour it's very hard. People are going to do things like that, attack basically harmless groups doing harmless things in a totally vicious way. That can happen. I mean, obviously, you know, in Gaza, the Israelis are sniping to dead toddlers. They've shot them in the head, shot them in the, you know, we know what's going on there. There's a motivation. There doesn't seem to be any rational motivation for this at all. From what I hear, although again, this is just still floating around in the internet and so on, he's got, you know, he's basically, he was autistic. Finds it difficult to form relationships, all of that sort of stuff. I mean, you know, this is some school shootings in the US. I mean, what is the point of going into school and shooting all these people? People do it, though, don't they?
Can I suggest things like violent video games?
That might be part of the story, Tony. I'm not saying it isn't. I just don't know.
No, neither do I. But it's quite reasonable, I think, to speculate on why some 17-year-old might do that. I mean, there's also just a general feeling of Well, despair amongst a lot of kids of that age. They're men coming of age. Obviously, you know, the same sort of thing is true for women too, but particularly for young men. And looking ahead to their work careers, feeling rather depressed, wondering if there is a future for them, not wanting simply to go to college to put it off for a few years, to plunge themselves into tens of thousands of pounds of debt. The country doesn't really seem to be offering 17-year-olds that much nowadays.
Well, that may be true, but I think it's a bit of a stretch to try and put this particular incident in that context. I think it's most likely that what we're dealing with here is an extremely disturbed individual. I mean, that's my guess at this stage. There may be more to it, and as you say, there may be other issues to be looked into. But I mean, to be honest with you, if you think about it, in the United States of America, this kind of thing goes on all the time, and that's where we're going. More American.
I don't think it's quite true to say it goes on all the time.
It does.
In the States.
It does. People are killed all the time for no reason whatsoever in the United States because, as you say, the culture has become rather toxic. They've got access to guns, not just knives. You can imagine if you turned up with a machine gun, yeah, an AR-15. They'd all be dead, not just three of them. Thank goodness you haven't got access to that.
You've done quite a lot of darkness cursing there. Any light at the end of the tunnel?
Well, what happened is he was arrested almost immediately because, of course, there's no way he's going to escape. And then we could all just try to work out what was going on. But then, of course, other people, we know who they are, decided that they were going to turn it into an opportunity to create even further trouble.
Well, you mean it's the EDL, Tommy Robinson?
Yes, and the social media storm that was blown up immediately, totally wrongly, about it being a Muslim who'd carried out the attack when it patently isn't. He's actually probably a Catholic if he's from Rwanda. So the English Defence need to start burning down Catholic churches, surely, because the Catholics are obviously the responsible for Rwanda.
You're skipping over this because what happened is because of his age, he's just about to turn 18. In fact, next week I think he's 18. The police have withheld his name, and in that hiatus over about 2 days or so, the Tommy Robinson EDL style far right racist groups around the country and around the world were spreading lies about the identity of the person. Now, surely the obvious thing for the police to do as soon as these things start spreading around is to get onto a news bulletin and say, no, it's not this guy.
Well, I think what happened is a magistrate yesterday said, we're going to release his name. He's apparently going to be 18 next week. They were going to leave it. They said, no, we're going to release it now, so this will put all this to bed. But of course,
too late.
Sorry?
Too late.
Well, yes, but don't forget, in general, people follow the rule book as the rule book says. And if he's under 18, you're not supposed to say who it is until they've found out. You know, but nobody's entitled to just jump to conclusions about anything, are they?
This alleged killer was protected, whereas the kids weren't.
Well, these are the rules of what goes on. You can say, well, we're not going to bother with the rules, Tony.
There's no rule that says the police can't issue a denial.
No,
When a false name is circulating, there's no rules whatsoever to tell the police they can't issue a denial, because they know the name.
All right.
They're just not allowed to say it. And if someone starts circulating false names, lies about someone being a Muslim, for example, the police should surely get on the next BBC News bulletin, say, this name is circulating, it is wrong.
Well, okay, I take your point.
Nothing to stop them doing that.
I take your point, Tony, but of course, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing.
They've got to be proactive. The police press officers have got to understand that there is a far-right menace out there, and as soon as the far-right starts spreading lies like this, it's up to the police to get on the case.
Well, you can imagine the police are actually in Southport. It's quite a relatively quiet place, you know. They've been overwhelmed with trying to deal with the actual murder. So worrying about what people are saying on the internet...
The press office is not,
Well, yeah, I take your point, Tony. Yes, they probably should have done that. Would it have stopped them?
Yes, it might well have done.
That's debatable, isn't it?
There could have been some sort of decision, I would imagine, through the courts to release the boy's name.
Well, that's what's happened. The courts have decided to release it after the event.
So anyway, the fact of the matter was there was an enormous demonstration on Tuesday. Was it on Monday night? I'm not sure.
It was an enormous demonstration. 300 people from all over the country.
That's quite big, just on an instant. And it's mostly been fueled and fired up by these lies and this disinformation. I take a step back from this sometimes and I think, well, maybe here what's happened is there's been a deliberate information vacuum set up so that groups like the EDL can jump in on it.
Well, it may well be, Tony, that underlying all of this is a Gladio structure inside the deep state. We certainly know that they've been work. The EDL and the Al-Najib Harun both grew up like two little mushrooms in Luton some years ago, when the Anglian regiment had just come back from Afghanistan. Do you remember Afghanistan, that great war that we won? We spent 20 years killing local people, and then they kicked us out. But anyway, the Royal Anglian Regiment had just come back from Afghanistan, and they were marching through Luton, and then suddenly, out of nowhere, came Al-Majid Harun, who were holding up signs saying, kill British soldiers, and on the other side of the road were people from the English Defence League saying, kill the Muslims. They both arrived simultaneously on that one occasion, and I think both of those organisations are deeply infiltrated by the deep state, as was true in Italy in the 1970s and 1980s. So if you think there are no spies inside the EDL and inside Al-Majid Harun run by the government, I have a suspension bridge to sell you. This is quite likely possible that this could be happening, Tony. You are right, but we haven't got enough evidence at this stage to make certain what's actually happening.
I don't think we're trying to pretend to do make any certainties here. What we're doing is we're doing exactly what Keir Starmer yesterday told people not to do, which is to speculate, but to speculate responsibly about the possible role of the state here.
Oh yes, well, the English Defence League and Al-Majid Harun, Captain Hook, who was put all over the TV and the newspapers, this evil guy, he was an MI5 agent, and of course it's quite possible that Tommy Robinson works for MI5. He's
Abu Hamza.
Head of security.
Martin, you're just talking about Abu Hamza.
Abu Hamza.
Can we just stop on that point for a second? Because at Finsbury Park Mosque, I can remember you and I were working quite closely with the Muslim community over the 7/7 London bombings. They were telling us, and they were telling the national press, pretty much straight away after in 2005, the 7th of July bomb attacks on London, they said, well, we were telling the police about this group in our mosque and Abu Hamza and a guy called Harun Aswat, who were operating within their mosque. They wanted the police to get them out, and nothing was done about it.
That's right. So in other words, if we can go back into the history of Al-Majid Harun and the English Defence League, but of course we still don't know exactly what's happened in this particular incident yet.
No. Joe, would you like to chip in?
Yeah, I was just going to wonder, just put to Martin, that by immediately going for that kind of manipulation, are you not in danger of doing the same thing as the Liberals are doing, where they're blaming it all on Russian disinformation?
Well,
when there are clearly grounds here that this is all emerging out of, which has to be acknowledged.
Well, I think
around mass immigration, I suppose.
Okay, yes, okay. Well, there's all sorts of issues that we could be. I mean, my particular expertise is deep state manipulation. Mm. Yeah. So that's what I talk about. Mm. But of course, there are other things going on. Yeah, of course there are.
In a way, what we're dealing with is a really kind of information battle over a particular incident, which the police have been caught on the hop, really, as they've not been releasing information. And absolutely, the idea of an information vacuum on something where people have such strong feelings, everyone being told, well, no one's going to know why, it's not the time to ask questions. Of course, during that time, obviously, many are mourning, but also many are also asking questions right across the country: is how can something like this happen? And during that 48 hours or so, there was really no information whatsoever about this alleged suspect, which is what makes me suspicious that there's something a little bit more going on here. A group like the EDL have simply seen their chance and gone for it. Now, this isn't the first time this sort of thing's happened. Surely, Martin, the police could have been a bit more on the case.
All right. I think it is legitimate to question whether the police got this right. Just as it's questionable what happened in Manchester Airport the other day, whether did the police get that right? And always the police are open to be criticised if they get stuff wrong.
Well, no, they didn't. I mean, if you've seen I retweeted the full footage of that incident at Manchester Airport. It was quite clear that the police were acting. I mean, these guys were violent, but the police were acting in a very thuggish way towards the individual. They didn't seem to want to just apprehend and arrest them. They seem to want to beat them up.
Yes, well, that's because I understand one of them had broken the nose of a women police officer, and that's the sort of thing that gets guys going, isn't it? They're supposed to be professionals, they're not supposed to do it, but there you are. And of course, if there'd been no video or film of it, as used to be the case back in the 1970s, then nobody would be any the wiser, would they? But there we are.
No, there's a whole issue here about trusting police, isn't there? I mean, that's... Obviously, the police did their job on Monday, but at Manchester Airport, people looking at that video start to think, well, do we tell the police anything? What's the point another gang?
Well, it's obviously the role of the police is obviously going to be controversial. Some people are going to be happy, some of them not very happy about what they do. I don't think it makes much sense to just blanketly condemn or blanketly support. So it depends whether they get it right or not.
In the background to all of this, there is a EDL, Tommy Robinson Group, which has weaponised the whole migrants issue. Would you agree, Martin, that there is a difference between being a racist and being critical of the level of migration to Britain?
We can have a debate about immigration, if you like, if it's a debate. But, of course, he's actually hostile to Muslims as such. The big thing about the EDL when it first started is we are anti-Muslim. So it wasn't really even about immigration as such. It's about Muslim immigration, about replacing the white Christian community with these Muslim. Islam's an evil faith.
When he turns up to these pro-Zionist demonstrations,
right. The EDL sees itself as very pro-Israeli. For example,
well, they're migrants. The Israelis are migrants.
Well, they are indeed, because that's not their land. But they've turned up and they're running it, not just turning up, but running the place, killing the locals.
So let's just have a little look at some of the migrant statistics, because this is an issue which doesn't seem that the Conservative, many people expected that after Brexit and Boris that something would be done about the level of migration. And whether you think it's okay or not doesn't really matter. You've just got to look at some of the statistics. In 2023, the net migration to Britain was 685,000 people. There have consistently been people migrating to Britain. More people were migrating since 1993, that's 30 years ago, when the net migration figure was negative, so about 1,000 people left Britain back in 1993. And ever since then, it's been migrants have been coming into the country from the EU. It's declined since Brexit of 2026, but the migrants from non-Brexit countries have accelerated rapidly since 2021. The Blair government in 1997, actually increasingly up between 97 and 2000, migration has been the main driver of population growth. The main driver of recent immigrations are people studying and working in healthcare. In 2021, the new graduate visa was introduced, and that's only, 3 years ago. The visa gave foreign students the opportunity to stay in Britain and work for up to 3 years after completing their studies. So that, I imagine, will be about 6 years, and that's brought a lot of people in on these legal student visas. In 2020, the skilled worker health and care visas were introduced in 2020, so yeah, that's 4 years ago, and that's also led to a massive increase. And this is what, Martin, you're always talking about, the healthcare workers, and we couldn't run the health service without them. That's many of these people. Illegal immigration, which is the people coming in on the boats mainly, is roughly, would you like to both of you guess roughly how much that is of the total, Martin?
It's nothing like even half of it.
Go on. Roughly
5%.
Martin?
8%.
8% is right. Oh. You're reading it, aren't
you? Yeah. No, I'm not reading it.
Okay, no, very good.
But it just means, Tony, is that 88% of the people come. It's 88%.
Well, this is what is ridiculous.
Are actually legal migrants.
We're going to hear the point made by Heiko Kuh in a minute, I hope. Most of the migrants are nothing to do with the boats. So 8% of them in the year ending June 2023, that's 52,530 illegal migrants entered Britain, up to 17% roughly from the previous, up 17% from the previous year. 85% of those entered in small boats. So most of the illegal migrants came in small boats. But there's your figures. Most of the migration is caused by visas, and yet the EDL, Tommy Robinson Brigade, are just blaming everything on the small boats.
Well, it's a common mistake for people to make, isn't it? I mean, most people have much idea who lives in the town they live in Bristol. What's the actual, you know, how many different people are in different groups? I work for the council, and we used to have access to the stats. But if you didn't have access to the stats, you'd be just guessing, wouldn't you? Just guessing. And most people are just guessing. And, of course, when you ask ordinary people in the pub or whatever how many illegal migrants are coming in on boats, they will say, oh, it's, you know, They just don't know the facts. And they don't want to know the facts either.
Since 2010, we've had around about 6 million migrants now. Let's have a listen now to audio clip on that.
The mediocre economic performance since 2010 has been flattered by the 6 million population surge between then and 2013. This is according to the Resolution Foundation think tank. So this is a pretty left-wing think tank, but at the same time, the numbers not entirely adding up. What do you make of it?
Well, I'm not surprised. I've actually been calling on this for probably about 4 or 5 years. And certainly when I started drafting papers for the government about the impact economically on the United Kingdom, that it would be negative. I mean, let me try and, if I can, take two big pieces of economic data for people and try and break it down. GDP, which is loved by politicians, the Bank of England, and think tanks who support large growth, is about just the economy of the companies, governments, and people in a country. And it rises by you getting more and more people in. Just so you keep putting people in, it rises and rises because it's based on the idea that more people spend more money. And that's why governments love it, because they can say, look, we look great. And if you fail in two quarters...
I mean, in fairness, Stephen, it is an internationally recognised way of working out how big a country's economic output is. But I totally get your point in that. I imagine the next sentence you're going to talk about GDP per capita, as in
that's
how
right.
much individual person actually brings into the economy.
Yes, because GDP per capita is about how you and I, how much wealth we have. And what we've seen from the statistics from the Office of National Statistics is saying that GDP per capita, which shows how wealthy we are as an individual, has fallen. It's fallen by 0.7% over the last couple of years. And what that means is that every individual is £100 poorer just because of the rise in GDP over that period of time. And why does that matter? It matters a great deal because whilst you've got this groupthink in government that's saying GDP is great, it means that it's brilliant for asset owners, people who own houses and big businesses. But what it also means is they're not automating. It's led to a reduction in wages over a period of time because they don't have to increase it. It has big environmental costs because the more people that you get in, the more houses you've got to build, the more roads that you've got to get in. And in further on, you also have to increase taxes or borrow, as this government has, to pay for it. So you get increased costs to the country of our interest rates to the international community. So as a whole, this think tank is correct. It's showing very clearly that as you have more immigration into the country, it makes each individual poorer. And although GDP rises, the big difference there is that I think now research is beginning to look at GDP, is that it's actually, Peter, helping the richest people in this country grow, not the poorest.
And that's from the Resolution Foundation, Martin. So this whole idea of migrants, well, they are coming in and they're working in the National Health Service, but actually, as a whole, the country's poorer.
Well, let's think about GDP per capita. GDP per capita is a pretty silly measure. I accept that GDP is a very crude measure. It's just how big the economy is. It doesn't matter how many people you've got. GDP per capita is also a silly measure because in actual fact we don't all have equal salaries, do we? Some people are wealthy and some people are poor. Now in actual fact
if the GDP per capita is going down, that means more people are poorer.
Yes, because the economy in this country has been mismanaged, unlike the economy in, say, China, for example, where it grows by 5% a year.
Year in, year out. Yeah, I think you're getting off the point, though, are you? Because we know that the West is collapsing economically. That China and Russia and the BRICS countries are parts of the world which are successful. Yes. They're looking at our part of the world and they're saying, "What a basket case! We don't need to do that." What we're trying to do here is to analyse our own economy and what might fix.
Well, I'm trying to analyse it, Tony, but you've got to go deeper in. The GDP per capita isn't a very good measure either. So he's using that. And he's not from the Resolution Foundation. He's somebody critiquing the Resolution Foundation. He's not from the Resolution Foundation.
No, but he's quoting the statistics.
Now, the real reason why the economy hasn't grown in this country over the last few years is because of the cost of living crisis. The cost of living crisis is because we're in an alliance with the United States of America, which blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, and the whole economy of Europe is going down the drain in spades. And it's not to do with immigrants coming in, especially not on small boats. Don't forget the immigrants that are coming in. If we had proper wages in the health service, they would have a higher per capita income. Because the more you spend on the health service, the more GDP goes up. But of course, we don't want to spend too much money on the health service.
Isn't the point of having low wages in the health service that that you can drive the cost of the health service down and bring in migrant labour to do it?
That's exactly what we're doing.
And because the local people won't work for that amount of money.
Yes, exactly. So what you need to do is increase wages in the health service, which probably means increasing wealth taxes on wealthy people. Put it back to the 1950s, when the top rate of tax in this country was 96%. We're not going to do that. It's less than 40%. Now, if you're not going to do that, then you're not going to get locals to work for the wages that they've got in the health service. Incidentally, if you massively increase the spending in the health service, and the government now has agreed to pay all of the outstanding demands in the public sector, teachers, health workers and so on, that actually boosts GDP, because any government spending is just added to GDP. It's just added on. Yeah. So if in actual fact we could have a largely socialist economy which would have a much bigger GDP, but of course the wealthy would actually have to lose a lot of their second homes, foreign holidays and all the rest of it. That's exactly how we used to run it in the 1950s. And of course there was a labour shortage, so Enoch Powell went to Kingston, Jamaica, when he was the Transport Secretary, and he recruited
It was a well-paid labour shortage. In other words, that the wages were pretty good, and also the housing costs, the electric costs, all the basic costs, the water costs, the transport costs were all negligible in those days.
Well,
in the 1950s,
they were dealt with by the government instead of all the privatisation.
For anyone that was renting, they didn't pay any water at all. No. And in fact, like in Ireland now, they don't pay
They have to. They didn't pay one stage, but after the crisis in 2008, they had to pay
for it. What I'm saying is these things were available pretty much at cost price.
Yes.
When you were buying a house or renting a house, whatever you were doing, you weren't paying over the odds. Now what we've got is a massively restricted market in housing and price fixing going on in fuel, electricity, water, everywhere.
So in other words, the problem isn't the immigrants who are coming in to keep the health service going, and also the ones who are coming in to study. These are the kind of immigrants you want. They're going to set up businesses. They're going to create wealth.
Well, that's if they're allowed to stay. But the universities are complaining at the moment. They're saying, "Well, look, we're not getting enough foreign students coming in, and we may go bankrupt."
Well, that's one of the problems. You see, if the Tory government said we've got to cut these visas back, and of course, then they're not going to come here. They're going to go somewhere else.
Isn't the problem that we're becoming dependent in every way, including on things like coal imports from abroad, including people?
That's right. But that is decisions taken from the 1980s onwards, and a lot of people who don't like the immigrants are the people who voted for all of that. They voted Tory every election.
The immigration, Martin, took off in the 90s, late 90s, not in the 80s.
Yes, it took off in the 90s because what the British did, and it was quite clear, it was across the spectrum, is we pushed for a rapid expansion of the EU eastwards. The Germans and the Austrians were a bit more dubious about that, but the Americans and the British, no, we're going to expand it eastwards, we're going to bring all these East Europeans in as quickly as possible to mess the Russians up, because we know it'll annoy the Russians. And that's why we did it. And of course, the consequence is they came, because we allowed them to come. Britain could have said, both Germany and Austria said, we're only going to take a certain amount of people from each of these countries, because they're closer to it. So they've got in a sense that these people are going to come, we don't want them all coming all at once. And of course, in East Germany, you've got a whole load of people who were Germans and now part of Germany. But in actual fact, they're still economically underprivileged compared to West Germany.
So, what do you make of Rachel Reeves' announcement? A lot of the news this week was dominated by Southport, but actually, there's a very important announcement on Monday by Rachel Reeves. She's saying there's a 20 million black hole in the public finances right now, and so a lot of the things they wanted to do, well, we're very sorry.
Well, I mean, what I'd say about that is the idea that there's a black hole in the finances is totally dependent on the government's fiscal rules. And in order to keep the City of London happy and all the rest of it and win over the potential Tory voters who might vote Labour, they promise that they're going to stick to these various spending targets, and that's what they're going to do. Now, in actual fact, that's silly. You don't do that. What you do is you say, well, what do we need to spend money on? You spend that money and then you think about where you're going to get it from. You can print it. You can raise it from taxes. They said, well, we're not going to raise taxes on wealthy people. Vote Labour. We won't take any money off you. But in actual fact, these people don't vote Labour anyway.
We could have said to them, we're going to take the money off you
and we're a majority.
You remember Richard Murphy in the days of Jeremy Corbyn saying, well, we could have something called the People's QE, where we just print money and spend it on the things that we need to. Now, is that feasible? Is that possible?
It is feasible. feasible because the banking system collapsed in 2008. They were nationalised, you remember? Large chunks of it were nationalised. Now, once you've nationalised...
Bailed out, I think, is a better...
Well, no, you're bailed out because it wasn't national. They were had to be nationalised. RBS was nationalised. But, of course, what ultimately happens is we can't have non-private banks because that's just... We can't have them. So we've run back to the situation where we bailed it all out.
The best people to manage the economy are the City of London Blue Blood Bankers.
Well, that's right. And this was the opportunity. You see, somebody like Gordon Brown, who's actually got some background in economics, could have suddenly said, right, if we're going to take over all these, and he was the one who said, let's nationalise.
I've saved the world.
Well, that's right. But the point is, you've saved the world, you're then in charge. And you say, right, well, we are going to run this from now on. But that's not what happened. There's a neoliberal consensus that, in actual fact, the banks have to be private. There's no rule that says that. They're not private in China, for example, which is another reason why they've got a more successful economy than we've got, because they don't do it like us. And, of course, what this then leads to is, because we've bailed the banks out, we've then got to cut spending on health, education, the police. There were 20,000 police officers were let go. I was saying this the other week on the show. The Trinity Road police station was built during that era when the Labour government said we're going to spend a bit more money on the police. So they built a state-of-the-art police station. Then the Tories came to power and said, we haven't got enough money to put police in it, so we'll just leave it empty. And now they've knocked it down and they've just gone. That's a state-of-the-art police station with everything that you might want in a police station. It just sat there empty and now they've knocked it down. That is a waste of money. If you're going to build a police station, you might as well staff it with police and get on with it and say, well, find the money somewhere.
You're better off owning your own land as well, rather than just constantly renting these various... places. Anyway, let's have a listen to Rachel Reeves, or at least some of the commentary on Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, talking about the... I was reminded very much of when the Conservatives came in 2010, Martin, and they said, oh, we've got a little note in the Treasury saying, sorry, the money's run out, there's none left. It's like Rachel Reeves has done the same. George Osborne did that back then. Rachel Reeves has done trying to do the same, and in fact it's very similar to what has happened here in Bristol under Marvin Rees when he inherited the mayor job from George Ferguson. He said, oh, we're very sorry, but the public finances are terrible in Bristol, we're going to have to make loads and loads of cuts, where George Ferguson had been, should we say, creatively using the budget to try and keep important things like public toilets open. That was just decided not to be possible. So it may be that this is going to be a bit of a mega cuts. Before we hear the commentary, Martin, do you think that's what's going to happen in the autumn budget? There's going to be enormous new tax rises, and we're not going to get very much for the public sector from this Labour government.
I think they've laid out their stall pretty clearly. I mean, the other thing that really annoys me is she said the infrastructure spending is all going to be done through the private finance initiative. Now, if something's worth doing, then the public sector should just do it. But if you go to the public, the private equity firms and say they are going to build the new hospitals and all the rest of it, and they are going to own them, which is by far the most expensive way to do it. But of course they love that because it's free money for them. It's guaranteed by the government, and what's not to like? And it's quite clear the direction of travel is like this. What I fear she's going to find is that as we go forward, what with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline blown up and everything, the economy isn't going to grow. The private sector isn't just going to rush forward to invest. Mm. There's been very, very little investment in this country, hardly any foreign direct investment since 2016 and the referendum. And of course, these things are coming to a head now. Because
so the only people left to invest, really, are the government. And she's saying, well, we don't really want to, thank you.
Well, that's right. But she will find that she can't, in that case, the economy won't grow. There is no way that the private sector is just going to magically have a boom to keep the Labour government
in
power.
Okay, well, let's listen to the commentary on the announcement on Monday about the £20 billion black hole.
Spending has run over. Departments have got more that they need to pay for than they've got money coming in. And all in all, £20 billion quid in the red is the bottom line. And that's already got suggestions running wild in Westminster that Rachel Reeves is paving the way, within weeks, in fact, of becoming Chancellor, for tax rises. That this big disclosure about the finances being even worse than they thought is basically a pretext and a precursor to an autumn budget in which the Chancellor stands up in the House of Commons and says, we didn't want to do this, the situation is far, far worse than even we realised when we took power. Taxes are going to have to go up. Now, it's not going to be some taxes, because Labour's very, very clearly ruled out increases in income tax, VAT and national insurance. But of course, They were very, very careful not to rule out tax rises in things like inheritance tax, council tax, potentially capital gains tax too. So it looks like, and this is early days, but it looks like tax rises are coming towards us this autumn.
Council tax, inheritance tax, maybe not so important, significant, although, of course, the tax thresholds are coming down in real terms all the time. So catching millions of people in London who don't think of themselves as super rich, it's just that their properties have become worth a lot of money, and so they won't be able to pass those on to their kids, most likely. But the big one is council tax, isn't it? I mean, this is one of the things people surely cannot afford to pay. Many people are having to pay council tax who can barely pay the rent.
Well, we need to get rid of council tax. We need to get the...
Is Rachel Reeves considering getting rid? I don't think she is
no,
she?
No, this is the problem. The situation, in fact, surrounds radical solutions. What they're trying to say is we don't want radical
solutions. Give us a
radical
solution, then.
Get rid of council tax and bring back the rates like they've got in Northern Ireland. And, of course, that means that wealthier people will pay more.
That will probably mean the house prices go down, won't
yes,
it?
Yes, and that means somebody can get on the housing ladder. Yeah. What's not to like?
Good idea, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what will happen, of course, is the big banks and private equity firms will be snapping up those houses.
Well, that's what's going on in the US. Yeah, that's. I mean, the crisis of capitalism cannot be solved by tinkering, yeah? And she's just a tinkerer. She doesn't want to do anything radical. She may be forced to do more radical things than she wants to because of the situation. I think there really is plenty of scope for things like capital gains tax to be increased. Why should somebody who stags shares and makes money on the city in the city, why should they pay less on that than somebody who goes out to work every day as a doctor or a dustman? You know, there's no reason for that at all.
What about just taxing people every time they bet on the stock exchange? That seems
Tobin
to make
taxes,
more sense. I mean, otherwise, what you're doing is you're taxing people here, and also you're taxing. Say, for example, they've been taxed on their income as they get their savings and they put it into a bank account and they save, which is what you want them to do, so that money can then be invested. You're taxing them again, and this is the same with inheritance tax. People have been taxed all the way towards buying a home, and then you said, oh, you're dying now, you're going to pass this on to your kids, we're going to tax you on that too. So the taxes, people are being taxed on not only on the money coming in, but also as they try to spend it or invest it, they're being taxed. Now, this is a sure way to really to crash an economy, isn't it? If you're saying that anyone that actually does something with their savings or even starts thinking about savings, we're going to tax you.
The real problem, Tony, is that we don't actually need savings. What you need is people going out and spending their money. Marginal propensity to consume. So countries which have high savings ratios, like Japan, have been in stagnation for many,
don't
many years.
Families have a right to have some money saved up for various contingencies or for holidays or whatever?
Yes, some people are allowed to save money. We're not trying to stop people saving money, but some people...
The main problem, surely, is that it's abroad, a lot of this money.
Yeah, a lot of it's abroad. And don't forget that some people are very, very much wealthier than others. In the Rights of Man, which I presume you've read by Tom Paine, the whole second book of the Rights of Man is about how inheritance is fundamentally wrong. Nobody should inherit anything from their parents. Everybody should have to start as an ordinary person.
All the houses will be owned by Barclays.
All the houses will be owned by housing cooperatives or by the council. That's what happens in Cuba.
It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
None of it's going to happen, Tony. None of it's going to happen.
Isn't it
What's
better
actually
that
going to happen
it's better
is
that
we're
people,
going to go into a massive crisis.
It's better that people and families own homes than massive financial institutions. That's what, you know, you're getting
just,
more and
I
more
would
like
just like to have some
state.
Social housing like you live in, Tony. Nice, yeah. Cheap rent. But I haven't got it. I'm in private rented. Just had a massive increase in my rent. Yeah? I don't want to live there. I don't want private.
What do you want to mention?
No, I want what you've got. A two-roomed house with a kitchen at the price you pay. What do you pay for a month in your house?
It's not what we're talking about.
No,
is it?
It's a lot less than I pay.
Well, you're not paying
Tony?
It either, are you? Because you're getting universal credit.
Yeah, but it doesn't cover all of it, Tony. I have to go out to work as well.
Yeah, so we're not just talking about social housing and you and me and you're jealous of me because I'm in social housing.
Uh-huh.
Well, I was squatting for many years. Were you jealous of that? Would you rather be squatting too?
Yes, I would have been squatting, but I was working. Squatting.
Yeah, I was squatting
occupation.
And working too.
All right.
No, it's not a full-time occupation. That's rubbish.
It was for me when I was doing it, I'll tell you.
Well, it was not. No. All right. I mean, I had a place for 2 years squatting. And I was working at the same time, so it was a decent, it was a good opportunity.
Right.
I was lucky, But, I mean, trying to personalise this is infantile. All right, what we're talking about here is you don't want to people owning their own homes. You'd rather financial institutions of various sorts want to own
them. No.
The realistic thing is if you're forcing people to give up homes, they're not going to be taken over by the council or by housing co-ops. They're going to be snapped up by financial institutions, private equity and banks.
Councils, if they were properly run and we had a proper system in this country...
We don't.
No, we don't. But if we did, and we're talking about what solutions rather than problems, then the council...
What should Rachel Rees be doing? Rather than making families lose their homes, what should she be doing?
As people die and their houses become available, the state should buy those houses up so people get some money for that house, and that house should then be available.
No hope of that, is there?
Well, it depends how bad it gets, Tony. Yeah? In the short run, no, there is no hope of it. Yeah. If we hit a massive crash, which is definitely coming, there'll have to be a change in policy, won't there?
In terms of land and finance, the state... is nowhere. The city is everywhere. Everywhere that's a distressed asset being sold off is being snapped up by Wall Street, the city and the big financial institutions.
Well, that's what will happen. That's what's happened in the US. There'll be another crash and then they will come in as vultures and try and take it all off us.
So this is the background, I think, against which much of this social unrest has been taking place. The idea seems to me to be to set poor white people off against poor black people.
Well, of course, it's part of the strategy. They've been doing it for years. They love doing it. In the US, there's a big problem because most people think they're just distressed millionaires, that they could be millionaires. Then at the moment they're sleeping in the street, but you know, once they get their social media company going, they could be millionaires. So we don't want to tax millionaires because I might be one day. It's rubbish. It's stupid. People need to understand that they're not going to be millionaires.
I think
everybody needs to pull together and make sure everybody's got everything they need.
What everybody really wants, Martin, is just the basics. That's what they want. Just a roof over their head. They don't want luxury yachts. They want some of the basics and they want them provided at cost. Is there any chance of someone like Rachel Reeves doing that?
Not in the short run, no, for the reasons we've all been discussing. But I think what may happen with a Labour government is if we have another crash like in 2008, that could easily happen in the next 4 years, then they will be in a position where they could take more radical policies. In fact, they should. And because they're Labour, they might. Although, of course, there's no guarantee of that because she's very much... You know, she was the one who said last year that the credit card was maxed out. Now, she used to work for the Bank of England. She knows that's rubbish. There's no such thing as a credit card for a country. It's just a silly remark. But it endeared her to the Daily Mail readers and the others that they're trying to convince.
Well, no, this is not so much the Mail readers too, but surely the main people she's trying to endear herself to are the financial institutions,
indeed,
the banks, the City of London.
And also they control the Tory press where a lot of this is discussed. When, you know, it's just endless misdirection about what's really going on. This country has been asset stripped completely over my lifetime, and that's why we can't get anything done. And of course, there was no reason for it. We could have carried on doing it as we did before.
So, I mean, one of the things that always bothers me is when you get people being driven into debt and mass poverty, like we've got child poverty now, which is not being addressed by Labour. In fact, anybody in the Labour Party that's trying to do something about child poverty has been booted out summarily from the party. People like John McDonnell, there are probably others. I don't know if Diane Abbott
Well, they've
Abbott
been suspended,
did.
Haven't they?
Yeah, well, that's right. They've lost the whip, so they're no longer officially Labour MPs. They can't. And if there was to be a general election, they wouldn't be allowed to stand as Labour MPs again. These are the sorts of disciplinary issues we've got from the present Labour Party. So what we've got is almost a powder keg waiting for some social unrest, isn't it? We've seen all this stuff in Leeds going on. The general population, particularly in poorer areas, Martin, are looking for someone to blame, someone to throw rocks at, aren't they?
Well, potentially, yes. And don't forget, I lived in Brixton in 1981. The Tories had just been elected. The local police were absolutely full of it. And, you know, it exploded and spread around all around the country. This weather that we're seeing now, yeah, we've got Tommy Robinson and his friends coming to Bristol tomorrow. And I'm quite sure that the sort of local anti-fascist crew will be down there. And we could have a riot in Bristol.
There will be
a
counter-demonstration, most definitely. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. But anyway, this is Tommy Robinson jumping into the breach this week because he saw this opportunity and he took it.
Before anyone starts condemning the angry English men, up in Southport, ask yourself this. What do you expect them to do? Yeah? What message have our police force sent? They run away in Leeds. You run away from the Romanians. You've got your dogs out tonight on the lads, haven't you? You run away. What message do you send when you said there was no evidence against the Muslim lads who kicked the f*** out of three police officers? You said there's no evidence and you let them off because you were scared because they get violent. So what message have you sent to the British public? You're going to bring total anarchy to this country because you're basically telling people whoever's loudest, whoever riots, gets heard. Well, the British need hearing. You've allowed people into our towns and cities that are raping their way through our towns. They're murdering our kids, left, right and centre. Women are being raped daily across every city in our country from the f***ers that you've brought in. You've opened our borders when you worry your care needs to be about our kids. You care more for Afghanis, Somalis, Eritreans, Syrians, Pakistanis. You care more for them. You put them up, you house them. They're a danger to us. They're a danger to our country, and you give more of a f*** about them than you do about British children. You are endangering our country. You're endangering every one of us and our families by housing men you know nothing about across our country, and to top it all off, we're paying for it. So before people get on quick and condemn the angry men, that anger is justified. Okay? I'm surprised it's took this long. And with your two-tier cowardice policing, you've actually encouraged the scenes you see tonight. You've done this. The government have done this. The police have done this. Your absolute cowardice has resulted in this. Children being butchered and murdered. And you, and the problem is, no one can believe a word you say. Because you continuously lie. Everything's a lie from you. No one trusts you. No one trusts your media. The entire nation is about to break down because of your foolish, weak, cowardly leadership. Stop the f***ing boats. Get them out of them hotels. Get them gone. Put them on boats and send them back. Okay? They shouldn't be here. They're endangering the safety of our families. Men will rise up. They're always going to rise up. They have to rise up to defend their families. You've brought this war on our shores. You've brought danger on our shores. You cowards. So that anger you're seeing, and that's just before people condemn them, yeah? Don't call them hooligans. They're justified in their anger. Yes, there's a better way to do it, but they don't see no better way. Because you know what? The government have told them, we only listen to rioters, we listen to violence. That's the message that's been sent by these b****s in control. And these weak police forces, I bet they're not as weak tonight. And no doubt they're out protecting. Anyway, that's my little rant for the night, because it's f***ing frustrating.
So that's Monday night, or Tuesday night, Tommy Robinson. Quite a lot of bleeping going on. But he's, too, I think, trying to tease out some rationale behind that. He's talking about housing, and he's also talking about two-tier policing.
Well, he's talking, but that is, you know, there's an awful lot of different things in that rant, isn't there? When he's mentioning all those countries, like Afghanistan, for example, we invaded Afghanistan 20 years
ago.
Can
you just address what I just asked you about? That's housing and two-tier policing. I think I would say a bit infantile, some of the points he's making. I'm trying to look at the more, reasonable things. He's saying, well, actually, foreigners are getting priority housing over Indigenous Brits.
That's because we haven't built any council housing since the 1980s.
But the priority could be otherwise, couldn't it?
It could have been otherwise, but it wasn't. And it wasn't the fault of the immigrants that are coming in here. It's the fault of Tory governments, which no doubt Tommy Robinson and his mates voted for. They voted to get rid of council housing. You can bet your bottom dollar they did. They didn't vote Labour, did they? And even if they voted Labour, they wouldn't have got council.
But what about this idea of two-tier policing, where migrant communities get more of a soft-touch policing than maybe Indigenous? That's one of the allegations he's making there.
Well, in Northern Ireland, the Royal Ulster Constabulary eventually had to be disbanded and completely reorganised because of two-tier policing. In there's an over-representation in our prisons of young black men. Yeah, they're the ones who are over-represented in our prisons and in our borstals. And if he wants a fight with the Muslims and the black lads, he will get one. And, of course, the police will be in the middle of all of that.
Well, it's maybe not. It may be there are other actors that also want to fight Tommy Robinson with the migrant community. fighting. Well, they
I think
they can then bring in measures appropriately.
Yes, well, okay, but I mean, if Tommy wants a civil war, he may get one, but whether he's going to like it is another matter. I saw him run away from the whole country early last week because he was about to be put on trial for lying about this Syrian 16-year-old who was nearly killed because he claimed that he'd been raping somebody when he hadn't, and he sued him for libel, and he lost, yeah, because it was actually a lie. And well, of course, the Syrians are here because we, MI6, you remember that white helmet? Our taxes were used to try and overthrow the government of Syria. It didn't work, and millions of people fled. And they were all supposed to go back when Assad went, but Assad's still there, and they can't go back because we won't lift sanctions on Syria. We've got sanctions on Afghanistan. Now, if people in Syria and Afghanistan can't get any work in their own countries because we've gone there and made it impossible for them to get work in their own countries, they might just turn up on your doorstep. Mightn't they? And of course, the British Army, the SAS, are actually in the dock as we speak for killing people in Afghanistan. War crimes, yeah? Just like the Israelis, just like the Russians, apparently. And yet, none of this is happening in Tommy Robinson's little world. Britain is an imperial power. That's why all of these people from the world are here.
It used to be an imperial power. It's not an imperial power anymore.
Yes, but the point
the reason the people are here is because we want cheap labour, and those people also want a better standard of living.
Well, those people who are coming in on visas would definitely fulfil that criteria. But if you actually think about the more established communities here, the people from the Caribbean, the people from this Indian subcontinent, it's because we used to rule those countries. And in actual fact, Britain did very, very well out of that. Those countries are poorer than they would otherwise have been if they hadn't been in the British Empire.
One person that's got a very different analysis to you is the former head of MI6, Director General of MI6, Sir Richard Dearlove, also Bilderberger. This is what he had to say about what he believes is the insight into the Southport stabbings.
What can you tell us about Russian fake news websites, Sir Richard?
Well, what I can tell you is that we're in a state of grey warfare with Russia. We may not feel that we are. They certainly think they are. And the information space to the Russians, the exploitation of that space, is a fundamental tactic in their conflict with the West. So if these bots have been used to stir up social media, through social media, a violent response, I'm not the slightest bit surprised. People just don't seem to understand the extent of, as it were, the Russian attitude to conflict and the way that every aspect of their relationship with us will be seen as a basis for attacking us.
Is their attitude to conflict, their attitude towards the UK, as grave as you can recall, Sir Richard?
Yes, I think it is at the moment. Certainly towards the West, the Russians think they're in a sort of existential conflict with us, and they are treating, that's their view of the international situation. I think we on our side are slightly more, we're complacent, and I don't think people necessarily understand the danger that we're in.
Mm-hmm. Had you heard of what is believed to be the website that stoked up the tensions we're witnessing across much of England now? Had you heard of Channel 3 Now, the news service of Richard, and if so, when?
There are a number of these organisations. I haven't specifically heard of that one, but since you told me you were going to ask me this question, I've rung up a few people, and clearly it's one of the sources of this sort of activity out of Russia, yes.
And who would determine the policy of, right, I tell you what, let's make up the fact that the actions in Southwood have been done by a 17-year-old asylum seeker from Syria?
Well, I think the people running these have a pretty open, I'm talking now in Russia.
Yes.
They have an open instruction to exploit opportunities as they identify them. They're not going to some to get political clearance from Putin to do this. It's just part of the nature of the way that they're set up and what they're told to do, and they have their instructions, they carry them out, and they're not going to act particularly with restraint.
Sanas Bilderberger, former MI6 Director General, Sir Richard Dearlove. He's blaming it all definitely on the Russians. So the exploiting the gap of the information vacuum there was on Monday about who'd done these killings and falsely claiming them to be done by a Muslim asylum seeker coming to Britain by a boat. This was not Tommy Robinson or any of his friends, but or MI5 maybe even, but the Russians.
Well, I think that's very self-serving of Richard Dearlove, isn't it? I mean, the Russians are to blame for everything. So he's another one who's jumping on the bandwagon. There's not a shred of evidence to suggest that the Russians had anything to do with this at all, really. I mean, where's the Russian connection here? There isn't one. In actual fact, we have been interfering in Russia quite a lot, so the Russians are very well aware that the British intelligence services were probably involved in the murder of Zakhachenko, who was the Prime Minister of the Donbass Republic. He was killed in a bomb in a light fitting. They know that the British are involved with Storm Shadow missiles, because, as we know, Starmer said in the NATO conference that British Storm Shadow missiles could be used to fire at bases inside Russia, and then the Ministry of Defence went to the Daily Telegraph and said, no, we don't want to do that because the Russians are going to fire back. We've been trying to destabilise Russia for years. Since Yeltsin was pushed out, the British and the Americans have been trying to get control back in Russia. They failed, but then they are supposedly the problem. The war in the Ukraine is happening right next to Russia. It's like if we were fighting a war in Ireland, yeah? Now, the war in Ireland has been going on for hundreds of years before the Russians were even involved or anybody knew anything about the Russians. It's just self-serving stuff. Tommy Robinson's stuff is self-serving. His stuff is self-serving. And, of course, if these fools carry on down the road we're on, we're all going to hell in a handbasket.
Well, no. What there will be is some kind of civil unrest. That's what they seem to be trying to stoke, isn't it? But the idea that it's the Russians rather than our own security services, there are many potential links between both the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, Foreign Secret Service, and our own MI5, and these far-right groups. Now, one of the other things that people may or may not be aware of is that many of these far-right groups are very closely linked to racist football groups as well, football supporter groups.
Most people are aware of that.
Yeah. Well, maybe they are, maybe they're not. They certainly are if they listen to this programme. We talk about this thing a fair bit. But these are groups which they have police infiltrators in. We know that, possibly special branch infiltrators in the racist groups. But the question, Martin's got to be, to what extent are these police infiltrating and to what extent are they actually steering some of these groups?
Well, I think these are the questions that have been asked in Ireland about the whole question of whether there should be a kind of amnesty for everybody involved in everything. And, of course, all political forces in Northern Ireland said, no, we're not having this. And to his credit, Keir Starmer said, well, we're going to drop that idea because there's still loads of things we don't know about what happened there and who did what to who. And nobody on any side is willing to accept any kind of whitewash of anything. Now, in actual fact, our own security forces have got a massive record of stirring trouble. And we know, because we made a film about 7/7, we know that, Netanyahu, for example, had a warning on the day of the attack, so he didn't go to his meeting at Liverpool Street, he stayed in the embassy. How did he get a warning? He got a warning because he knew what was going to happen. And that's what we're up against. That's the real threat to our democracy.
Yeah, so I think we'll wind up now by having a listen to Heiko Ku. He's a regular at Speaker's Corner. He does the Marxist Tours of London, and I'll put a full interview with this, a full version of this interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But here he is, and he starts to talk a little bit about last Saturday when there was a big march in London by the Tommy Robinson Brigade, and I'm not even sure what they call themselves. I just call them the EDL, even though the EDL is supposed to be disbanded. It's the same people with various different names and on similar social media groups, etc. So here's Heiko giving his take and some of his exchanges with Tommy. But before, I'm always doing this, before we hear from Martin, one of the things Heiko says, which we haven't got on this clip, is the way that over the years he's been a regular, in fact he did a programme for Resonance Radio in London, which was a community radio, which he then got elbowed off, rather like we got elbowed off BCFM, sadly, about Speaker's Corner, because he was a regular at Speaker's Corner every weekend. And he explained to me how Tommy Robinson used to organise these Free speech days at Speaker's Corner, invite everybody along, and then some of the Tommy Robinson thugs would start attacking Muslims. And the whole point was about free speech, but no, it wasn't really. It was to bring everybody in and intimidate them. It wasn't really anything to do with free speech at all. So what do you make of that?
Well, call me unsurprised. You know, how can you debate with somebody like Tommy Robinson was talking earlier? That's not a debate, is it?
No.
That's anyway, not a discussion.
Heiko had this to say about last Saturday's EDL march in London and the subsequent events during the week with Tommy Robinson.
After the Saturday event, which went off very peacefully, it's true, after that Saturday event, Tommy Robinson, in which he showed this film, he's got a penchant for showing films, in which he knew very well that, oh no, I'm going to go to prison for this, but I'm telling the real truth. There's a video about that online, you can find out about it, where someone takes apart his arguments that he was putting at the court. In any case, then on the Sunday night he was arrested, supposedly on terrorism charges. Now, again, a big hue and cry was made about Tom being arrested on terrorism. You know, it's legitimate, isn't it? He's not a terrorist per se. But on the Palestine demonstrations, there are many people who have been arrested on terrorism charges just for giving out leaflets. There was a young kid I met a little while ago. He's about 15 years of age, and he was arrested, then released. And there were other people who were arrested. And he's a consultant surgeon in a London hospital, and he wasn't doing anything wrong. Nothing at all there, and they got all the charges. So, you know, there's a principle at stake. If you're saying you're staying safe for a free speech, of course you have to defend those people who you disagree with as well. So Tommy Robinson against the terrorism charges. The awful thing was that although he was arrested under terrorism law, he was released after a few hours and given his passport back and allowed to leave the country, even though he was due in court the next day for contempt charges. And he fled the country. And then when the court case came, the amazing thing was they issued an arrest warrant for him only for October. And even then they said, well, he's got a chance to explain to the court why he's not here. Well, I mean, anybody with a three brain cells could figure out what happened to him escaping, escaping the judicial system. So it seems to have been quite orchestrated, and it could be accidental, but it sounds to me like some people have orchestrated his escape.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me, Heiko, as if, I mean, you're describing as well the police apparently supporting Tommy Robinson while you or others are getting beaten up and ignoring the fact that an assault is taking place because it favours, you know, in favour of Robinson. So there seems to be something a little bit theatrical about the way that the establishment deals with this guy.
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly true that on a number of occasions he's been quite severely treated. I mean, that is certainly true. But it seems to me, and he mentions this in a number of video interviews that I've seen with him, he mentions that the police and MI5 and so on have come to him and said, if you do this and if you do this. My own inclination is he's made some sort of deal with them. And that some of his financiers, there's a guy called Shilman, apparently, is a Zionist, who gives quite a lot of money to his campaigns. And there's a number of people who've broken away from him who are insiders in his campaigns who've described the way he behaves. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all if some sort of deals have been made with various levels of the intelligence agencies to serve their interests. And so one of the most heinous things in the last couple of days was after this horrendous killing by what seems to be some kind of Christian offspring of Rwandan, I don't know if they were part of the regime or whatever, the old regime under the when they carried out the genocide in Rwanda. But certainly that young lad, there's no indication that he was a Muslim, that he's a Muslim. There's no indication that anything associated with that was to do with Muslims. And yet, on Twitter, or X, Tommy Robinson's page, which of course is not run by him, was constantly pumping out stuff about Muslims and terrorism. And then the protests in Southport, some of the placards that were held up were "Stop the boats, and then the Lawrence Fox says, you know, drive out all Muslims, and then they say, you know, the killings are somehow connected. There has been no evidence whatsoever that anything to do with the killing of those children has any religious connotation or Muslim connotation. And so you have to ask yourself, why would you promote such an idea? And if you did promote such an idea, if you make a mistake on something like that, you know, I mean, any normal human being, any reasonable human being would turn and say, I was wrong on that. I over-exaggerated. I called it too early. I'm sorry. Because that's the only rational way an honest person will react. But instead of this, we've got a double downing of it and an extension of it, such that there are riots or protests taking place outside any location where refugees have arrived. And this is, again, it's a farcical thing, you know. I think last week there were 400 or so people came on the boats. Okay, you might not like them coming on boats, but there are thousands and thousands of people coming on aeroplanes. And many of them will stay in the country, overstay their visa permit and so on. So why the entire focus on those people who, for whatever reason, desperately want to come to England on boats? I mean, you can say that they should be dealt with, they should be stopped or whatever, but to focus entirely on them is a sort of, it's like a pogrom atmosphere that's developing. Mm-hmm.
Martin, pogrom atmosphere being developed, and also quite convenient, isn't it, that the main opposition, it seems, to the migrants from a racist point of view, well, they're just getting their facts all wrong, and it doesn't seem to matter.
Well, I mean, facts don't matter to certain people, do they? I mean, interestingly enough, Tommy Robinson's head of security is a guy called Kevin Fulton, not his real name, and he is, in fact, a British Army infiltrator into the IRA. And he was the guy that drove the bomb to Omar, okay? So, when you say, has Tommy got...
This wasn't this the biggest...
The biggest atrocity of the trouble.
Wasn't it after...
No, apart from that, actually, Dublin and Monaghan was bigger. But the point is that somebody like Kevin Fulton...
Hang on, this is after the Good Friday Agreement, wasn't it, Omar?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, Kevin Fulton, it's not his real name. We do know what his real name is. You can look him up. Declan Hayes is very good about all this stuff, if people want to follow all this up. And he is head of security for Tommy Robinson, ex-British Army, but an infiltrator into the IRA and the real IRA, but ex-British Army. So he was never punished for anything he did for the IRA or the real IRA.
I mean, has he just got a different assignment after the Northern Ireland peace?
Well, no, he's working now as Tommy Robinson's, last I heard, Tommy Robinson's
chief security. So he's nothing to do with the Army anymore?
No, apart the fact that he used to be in it for years. Yeah.
Anyway, fascinating way to finish on that one. But I think before we go to Joe, sorry, Joe, we've got one more clip which we're going to have to hear from.
Right,
oh, you got to go. Yeah. Oh, no. Come back. Come up. Then. Oh. Well, Joe did say he was going to have to go at 7.
Yes,
but,
well, that's it.
But that's... Joe, you're on, man. Well, he said he had to go at 7.
Yes, I know. He's got to meet somebody at 7.
Okay. So, anyway, the final clip. Sorry about that. Joe doesn't want to do that. So, is from Starmer, because he's read out something today. Yesterday, wasn't it? About Martin, can you say something about this? Because it's about using facial recognition and that sort of thing.
Well, I don't know exactly what he said, Tony, so I can't really comment. I mean, I didn't pick up on what Starmer said about this. I know he's had this meeting with the police chiefs and all the rest of it, and he's, you know, trying to play the stable, I'm in charge sort of role. That's what he's doing.
Yeah, so here he is.
I've just held a meeting with senior police and law enforcement leaders where we've resolved to show who we are. A country that will not allow understandable fear to curdle into division and hate in our communities, and that will not permit, under any circumstances, a breakdown in law and order on our streets. Because let's be very clear about this. It's not protest. It's not legitimate. It's crime, violent disorder, an assault on the rule of law and the execution of justice. And so, on behalf of the British people, who expect their values and their security to be upheld, We will put a stop to it. I want to thank all of the police officers across the country who have already, as they do so often, stood up to intimidation and violence in the past few days, and indeed throughout the summer. And let me be clear, the meeting this afternoon was not about pointing the finger of blame. That is not how this government of service conducts its business, because it doesn't work. Rather, this was a meeting to pull together our response, a response both to the immediate challenge, which is clearly driven by far-right hatred, but also all violent disorder that flares up, whatever the apparent cause or motivation. We make no distinction. Crime is crime. And so to that end, I can announce today that following this meeting, we will establish a national capability across police forces to tackle violent disorder. These thugs are mobile. They move from community to community. And we must have a policing response that can do the same. Shared intelligence, wider deployment of facial recognition technology, and preventative action, criminal behaviour orders, to restrict their movements before they can even board a train, in just the same way that we do with football hooligans. And let me also say to large social media companies and those who run them, violent disorder clearly whipped up online, that is also a crime. It's happening on your premises, and the law must be upheld everywhere. That is the single most important duty of government. Service rests on security, and we will take all necessary action to keep our streets safe. I'll now take a number of questions from the media. I'm going to start with Alex from BBC.
So, yeah, this is, I mean, you could look at this as a, of, not only as Tommy Robinson and the EDL exploited this attack in Southport, that also the government are also exploiting the unrest to say, well, we've got a whole load of wonderful new technology now here. We want to roll out facial recognition across the country.
Well, it could be, as you are hinting, a strategia di tensione, strategy of tension. And that's presumably what you're getting at. It might be, or it might just be everybody making it up as they go along. We'll just have to wait and see, won't we?
So what do you think of the government's response to it, saying, well, we don't need any new laws. What we do need to do is roll out technology across our police forces.
Well, it's the sort of thing you might expect him to say, and it's part of an agenda of surveillance, as we know. But of course, we're going there anyway, one way or another. And of course, there isn't going to be a nice ticking over of the economy and everybody getting back to work and all the rest of it. That's not what's going to happen at all. So the potential for conflict is palpable. And of course, what he's doing there, he's presenting himself as, you know, I am the strong chap you need to keep control of all of this and all the rest of it, which I imagine will go down reasonably well with many people, because they are actually quite appalled by what's happened over the last week.
Something else that happened this week in the chaos and the violence is a ditching of social care. This is a tragedy, says Dilnot, whoever Dilnot is. Chancellor Rachel Reeves' decision to scrap planned changes to the care system in England has been described as a tragedy by Sir Andrew Dilnot, the man who authored the proposals in 2011, all that long, long time ago, 12 years ago. Speaking on the BBC's Today programme, Sir Andrew said, "We've failed another generation of families." He said it was another example of social care being given too little attention, being ignored, being tossed aside. You can imagine his frustration, Martin, can't you? Is that there is a social care crisis, hospitals finding it impossible to discharge patients because they can't be cared for properly in their homes or in elderly people's homes or wherever, and there isn't enough money in the local authority budgets to pay for these things, and so you're ending up with massive bed blocking going on. It's a horrific crisis, and it's a very inhuman, and a way has been worked out by Sir Andrew Dilnot. But the government aren't interested.
Well, the reason they're not interested is because what you really need to do is start talking about inherited wealth. And they don't want to do that. So in other words, they just kicked it into the long grass.
Well, they already are talking about inherited wealth because people are having to sell their homes to pay for this care.
That's right. Not in Scotland, of course, because they've still got to...
Well, so what are you talking about inherited wealth for?
Well, I'm just pointing out that they don't really want to grasp this nettle because it means you're going to have to basically annoy a lot of people who don't
want... They could just print money, as we were saying earlier, and they could pay for this.
Well, that would cause inflation and therefore rises interest rates.
Would it?
Yeah, well, it could
do. This is a myth, really, I think, that inflation instantly is...
It depends where the economy is, whether you're at full employment and you've got all resources employed or not. Well, the point is that they're not prepared to do anything radical at all. That's why...
It's not radical. This is basically humanitarian,
the same problem we had...
Why is it radical to look after elderly people when they're coming out of hospital?
Because it costs money, and therefore the money's got to come from somewhere. The obvious thing to do is to have inheritance taxes, which are serious, so that people don't inherit more than one home, for example, but more than one, you're not going to inherit it, and that provides the resources to give everybody social care. They don't want to do that because it's all been pushed into the private sector, and that's what the Tories wanted, and they're not prepared to challenge the vested interests that have grown up. Why have we got private sector care homes at all? Because they go bankrupt, like Southern Cross. And then the government's got to come...
Occasionally they do. Quite often they don't.
Well, they do. In any case, you shouldn't have anything going bankrupt.
Anyway, the care system
should be in the public sector. There should be no question of them going bankrupt. Yes, it was, but it was privatised by the Tories.
There used to be
publicly owned care homes. There was one across the road here, right now.
And they all got sold off, didn't they? The care system is facing increasing demand from an ageing population because people are living longer with more complex conditions. Well, also because the state care sector has been destroyed by the Liberal, the Tory Libcon coalition in the 2010s. It's been widely viewed as being a crisis for years, underfunded and struggling to recruit enough staff. Caroline Abrahams, director of the charity Age UK, says the care system has gone from merely creaking to a state of near collapse in some places. Now, many people were hoping that Labour were going to do something about this, Martin. It sounds like the City of London have told them no.
Well, that's right. What they've done, which is justifiable in a way, is to talk down what they think they can do. Because if they do something, people will be pleasantly surprised. I can see why they follow that strategy. But on the other hand, the problems that the country faces are so dramatic, and in things like social care, not just social care, that this kind of steady as she goes, we'll just fiddle around with it at the edges here and hope we can do a little bit better than the other lot, isn't going to cut the mustard, is it?
Patrizia Opulenza sent this article from the Brownstone Institute, which you wrongly said was actually published on the Epoch Times. Epoch Times copied it from the Brownstone Institute. But anyway, 10 points about post-lockdown economics. The sudden economic lockdowns of March 2020, the world over, was one of the more shocking moments in history. The very core of the economic problems from the beginning of recorded time was getting more of what people needed to them in a way that was sustainable, given the inherent scarcities of the state of nature. Regardless of the system, creating wealth was the stated goal, and humanity gradually discovered that trade, investment, marketing, and access to more via travel and creativity was the way forward. All in an instant, these considerations were put on the back burner to combat what was supposed to be a deadly disease. Deadly disease or not, this was an enormous economic shock, wasn't it, COVID?
Yes.
And it was an opportunity to show, maybe to break some of the rules of the Thatcherite, shall we say, Milton Friedman-style economics.
Well, Rishi Sunak, who was definitely a Hayekian Milton Friedmanite, he was the one that said, well, we're just going to have to, because the Treasury told him, we're just going to have to open the spigots and spend money, as we did in World War II, in fact.
So what Brownstone Institute said, that the labour markets in the West have never really recovered. Both labour participation and employment remains below what was in 2019. Maybe this is the result of retirement. Maybe it's disability. Maybe it's demoralisation. It never got back to normal. Is there such a thing as normal when it comes to labour markets?
Well, there's no such thing as normal about anything. You know, what's normal is what's going on now, isn't it? The Brownstone Institute, Tony, it's the Epoch Times that have published it. The Epoch Times have published it, and they are basically Falun Gong, who are a CIA front organisation determined to break down the Chinese government.
As I said, this was the Brownstone Institute.
The Brownstone Institute itself is a right-wing economics think tank.
I'm sure there's lots of think tanks we deal with, left-wing and right-wing on here, all the time.
Okay.
So why does that make a difference?
Do you expect me to agree with the Brownstone Institute?
No, I don't. I'm not asking you to agree with it. I'm asking you. We're trying to critique it, and you're just trying to to rubbish it without even thinking. Mm-hmm. Stimulus was wiped out by inflation when the checks started arriving directly in people's bank accounts. People were doing absolutely nothing at home, and business was getting revenue from government even when their doors were closed. Now, this is all against the grain, isn't it? For most economists will say, no, you can't do this.
Well, they did it. We could go into the reasons why. I think it's a biological warfare attack on the Chinese communist system. That's what the start of it was.
We're looking at the economic aspects.
Okay, but the economic aspects, warfare is partly economics, and economics is
warfare.
They're all linked together, Tony. Yes, of course, it was a big shock. I think that what failed is because the communist governments in China actually dodged the bullet. They did what was necessary to control the virus, which they suspected, and probably rightly, as Jeffrey Sachs has pointed out, this was a created virus, and it was deliberately released. That's what I believe. That's what Ron Unz believes.
One of the other things this article talks about.
That's what Kirillov believes. He's the head of the Russian economics.
On the economic side of things, rather than the bacteria or virus or military side of things, one of the things that the article points out quite interesting is it's actually increased the push for different trade blocs to form around the world. When all supply chains in the world froze in March 2020, gradually reopened based on national politics, we saw the fraying of 70 years of global integration. Well, there's also a possible brewing wars in the background as well. But how much do you think COVID was responsible for these trade blocs becoming so much more powerful and more important now?
Well, if COVID was a deliberate attempt to try and nobble the Chinese economy, that's because they're becoming a very powerful trade bloc. They're reaching the point. This is. Do you remember Trump was going on about it at the time, and Peter Navarro, his advisor, we've got to get the Chinese now before they get better than we are. Because, of course, the Chinese are now coming into being the technological leaders, not just re-engineering stuff. They're becoming the technological leaders. And at that point, the Americans are going to lose their dominant position in the world economy, which is why, in my view, they carried out the COVID attack.
Well,
get what they wanted. The 9/11 attack was so that they could invade the Middle East and take over these various countries. They did what they wanted, but they lost the wars.
We try and just focus on the economic side of it, which I think is often neglected and interesting. And the Brownstone Institute, who I know you don't like them, but they're making some good points here. They're saying that central bank digital currencies are essential for a lot of the plans of these blocks around the world. And so the other aspect of COVID is it's pushing these ideas of these central bank digital currencies. Now, what do you make of that? Is that going to make a big difference in the future?
What if you read Michael Hudson on central bank digital currencies, he will tell you that the reason why the private banks don't like central bank digital currencies is because that would put them out of business. You wouldn't need any private banks at all. And of course, the Chinese are indeed developing a central bank digital currency. It's not going to be compulsory. It's a way of trying to get their entrepreneurs, to stay in China and not take their money out, because this is one thing that we can provide for you, easy access to money. The central bank stuff and the digital aspects of it is, if we're going to get rid of the dollar, and that's what these countries are trying to do, then you're going to need to develop it. The way to do it is to develop digital currencies which go around the dollar, and that's what they're exactly what they're doing, because it's economic warfare.
Well, I spoke to a chap called Ron Del Navo this week. He's from something called the Payment Choice Alliance. He says cash is more important than ever. Here he is talking about the recent outage, the CrowdStrike outage, where so many people couldn't actually buy or pay for things by cards, all sorts of other computer problems, particularly with Microsoft.
My name's Ron Del Navo. I'm chair of the Payment Choice Alliance. The alliance first started in 2014, but was relaunched in 2023 when we appreciated just how serious the position was in relation to the acceptance of cash. Cashless is being imposed on the UK, we feel, and the public don't want that, and that's what we're working very hard to stop happening.
Now, we've just literally, in the last couple of weeks, had a very sharp reminder of our reliance on the internet with the CrowdStrike outage, which has affected, payment systems, television broadcasts, the railways, the stock exchange breaking down. I mean, I think some of us have always been a little bit suspicious about our over-reliance on IT and technology. But can you give us your view? I don't know if you've really looked into it, how much you've looked into it as to what happened. You know, how come? I mean, your organisation has been flagging this up for a long time, but how can something like this go so ridiculously wrong?
Well, the thing is that this was a relatively junior person, as I understand it, in a software company making a change to the Microsoft system. And unfortunately, mistakes happen. I mean, we all know that our apps on our phones are upgraded and changed every single day. You know, we're always in the app store seeing what we have to do. But the issue is that when this is a change that affects most of the Microsoft systems around the world, that is a massive impact. I mean, you mentioned some of the impact. It changed hospital appointments. It stopped people finalising purchases of houses. It stopped us buying train tickets at machines and so on and so forth. So, you know, the simple thing is you cannot rely on these systems ever 100%. There are experts saying, oh, this will never happen again. Well, that's odd because it actually happened in March and April time when Tesco, Sainsbury's, Waitrose, for example, weren't able to accept cards or digital payments. So this isn't something that's a one-off. It's going to repeat and repeat, and that's why we certainly need cash as a backup to all of that technology stuff.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of things that come out of this. I mean, some would say, well, cash is actually subject to the same sort of problems. For example, counterfeiting cash.
Well, there have always been problems with any payment method. People used to steal shells when wampum was a payment method. I mean, of course, online payments are more badly affected than any other because they can do things like steal your identity and make off with the entire contents of your bank accounts. And that's not the same as losing your wallet with 20 quid on it or something like that, or even having it stolen with £20 in it. So, of course, there is always crime associated with every payment method. There's crime associated with jewellery shops, crime associated with chemists, but cash is reliable when it's in your hands. It has finality. Once you've paid for it, the transaction is concluded. And the reason that we've had it for 2,500 years now, it's great for the public in general. And 99% of the public are using it in an honest way, spending their money that they've earned honestly, and that needs to continue.
Now, with this outage, the CrowdStrike outage, we're being told the armed forces, the government, actually insist on people using Microsoft because it's so-called accredited. So
how can we get out of this situation? Is there
we have to resist. People have to. Everybody has to figure out ways every day of their lives of resisting. It may be that you have to leave your job. It may be that you have to do a civil disobedience every day. That may be going to a shopkeeper who has a posting on his shop that says mass only, and tell them I'm not going to shop here anymore, and I'm going to tell my friends not to shop here. Or maybe just going to another person. If you see somebody pushing a baby carriage down the street, hand them a card that says, here's the danger of injecting a child with a vaccine, you know, with these vaccines, and give them a fact sheet or whatever. Carry them on you and give them to people. The more people, the propaganda works. Everybody's being given the same lie message day after day after day. And what we need to do is to give the truth and do it repeatedly, so that when that woman is walking down the street with her children, that mother, she's hearing from three or four different people, don't vaccinate those children with this vaccine, without knowing what you're doing. And giving them her fact sheets, and that's how you spread, you know, our resistance, our revolution. But you know, I talked to some clients of mine a few weeks ago. There are a bunch of nurses, about 500 nurses, who are about to lose their jobs. They're about to be fired. And I said to them, are you sure you want to do this? It's going to put, you know, they have mortgages to pay, they have families to feed. And they said to me, this is the hill that we're going to die on, because if we don't fight now, there's no end, that we will be slaves. And life is not living if you're a slave.
It's almost as if people have been corralled into using a system which then has completely failed.
Well, I think Microsoft are too powerful, but so are Google, so are Visa, so are MasterCard. All of these companies are giants, and they're American giants. They're out with the control, really, of the British government and the British public. So it is a worry that there's so much reliance on one company. But the truth is, there are only three or four companies around the planet that do things like this, and we need to have more choice in terms of the kind of software providers as well. Choice has been limited in that sphere too, and that's dangerous because it makes it easier for the hackers to cause massive problems, or it makes it easier for one simple mistake to cause problems around the planet as they did a week ago.
So cash is king, Martin, do you think?
Well, obviously we don't want a system which is, you know, what we need is variety of different ways of making payments, some of which are going to be convenient for some people in different circumstances.
There is a sub-agenda behind a lot of this, isn't it, where the banks can see everything you're doing. If you're using electronic payments, they can see which terminals, where you are, how much is in your bank account, obviously, but they can set up a whole picture of your day-to-day activities.
Well, they can, and so can the tech companies, and so can anybody who hacks into what they're doing. So, yes, of course, there's a huge problem with it. You need to have cash. I mean, the Bank of England said this. We're not getting rid of cash. We don't want to get rid of cash. And in actual fact, there's been a modest resurgence in use of cash in the last couple of years. As people realise. There has, yeah. Because people have realised, you know, any system which is based on just one way of doing it is
going to be closing down the Royal Mint.
Well, I'm just saying that cash has increased. More cash has been used in the last couple of years than previously, although it's gone down massively during the pandemic and all the rest of it. I don't think there's any real plan to get rid of cash. Although obviously, those who are pushing digital currencies, like the big tech companies, they want to get rid of cash, but they're not necessarily in charge.
If you're doing
they?
Some sort of startup, I don't know, like a burger van or something, I can guarantee you'll find the bank trying to encourage you to use card payments. And also, the other thing is the banks are very sneaky nowadays at making it expensive for you to do things like deposit cash or take cash out from the bank if you're a business.
That's right. So they've got a vested interest in pushing that because they're private sector banks. If we had public sector banks with a policy to facilitate cash, that wouldn't be happening, would it? But then these aren't public institutions. They're private sector institutions driven by profit.
And also, we've got a government that could easily regulate them, but it doesn't. Why not?
Because they take a lot of money from them. Yeah, the Labour Party now gets loads of money from business. There were more business people at the Labour Party conference
another
than
lobby,
delegates.
Another lobby, another racket. So I also spoke, and I put the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Most importantly is this point about privacy, the idea that you might not want someone tracking and checking everything you buy. I mean, the thing is, for example, with these store cards, this kind of thing, when you buy something from the local supermarket, Tesco's or whoever, what's happening there is not only has the supermarket got all the information about exactly what you're buying, is it can exchange that with other groups. It can sell that information about you to anybody, really, possibly even to the bank to sell on, saying, well, here's this guy, he does this many transactions at these supermarkets and this is what he's buying.
Yes, and anybody else can hack into it as well. Foreign intelligence services, the Russians, for example, might be able to hack into
all
of that.
They can data mine everything.
Yes, everything can be data mined, can't it?
So I spoke to Ron Del Nevo from the Payment Choice Alliance also about this idea of privacy.
Privacy is a huge issue. People are rightly worried about the fact that, as you say, everything they do is known if you use cards. And there are lots of examples. We haven't quite reached that state yet in the UK, but there are lots of examples around the world of governments using that information to track citizens and then find them and then do what the government wants to do to their citizens. One example was in Hong Kong, but around the world there are an increasing number of examples of totalitarian governments using information that they get from electronic transactions. So it's something we really have to be aware of and guard against, and we can't allow that to happen here. We need cash to protect privacy.
The obvious one is China, where, for example, if you've got a low social credit score, you're simply not allowed to buy a long-distance train ticket.
Absolutely. And China is a scary country in many ways, in that they've actually imprisoned a lot of people, not by walls, but imprisoning them behind a software set up where, as you say, they can't buy train tickets, they can't do anything, they can't move from the local area. They also don't allow them to have jobs often. But one thing in China, you know, the central bank in China just came out and fined a lot of businesses for not accepting cash, because up to 240 million Chinese people are not attached to the digital society. And the Chinese government is aware that those people being left out is not acceptable. So even in China, although they have some extreme things happening, which are not good, as you say, on that social scoring basis, they are taking action to make sure cash is accepted, even in China.
So, yeah, a lot of problems with privacy, particularly. I mean, this is a mass surveillance, isn't it, that's going on here. Nobody's signing, no judge is signing off a bank saying, yes, it's okay for you to put these people under surveillance, are they?
No, because the technology has run way ahead of whatever rules there were about it. In the US, it's illegal for under the Constitution for the authorities to access any private communications whatever. So in other words, one of the things the revolutionaries in 1776 wrote into the Constitution, that private mail was inviolable and that the state shouldn't be allowed to look at private mail unless there was either a warrant for investigation of criminal activity, or B, a threat to national security. But the technology of watching people is way run beyond that. So, in other words,
that technology could be legislation around that technology. They just haven't bothered.
No, because don't forget, the people who are pushing this are the ones with the money, and they buy the politicians, and that's what we're doing. And of course, if you're a political activist or in a political party, you want all of that data because it helps you to get your vote out, identify who's likely to vote for you, and all the rest of it. And you know, this horse has left the barn. You know, we can huff and we can puff, but it's already left long ago. There it is.
Do you think cash will survive? How long do you think it will survive?
Well, I think if there's a big crash, which I think is going to happen, there's going to be lots of illegal activity, as there already is, and even more of it, that doesn't run on that basis.
I mean, surely there's not going to be a crash, because what there is going to be is an enormous squeeze. So bit by bit, people's wealth is, even, you know, for the middle classes and the poorer people, is going to be taken off them by, I suppose, a bunch of super rich who've got most of their money offshore.
Yes, that's already going on, but the system itself is inherently unstable. Because in actual fact, if you impoverish people, as we were talking about earlier, 0.7% fall in per capita GDP, then they can't go out and spend any money because they ain't got any. And ultimately, of course, that's what makes capitalism work. What's made it successful from World War II until the 1970s is rising real wages. Real wages rose year on year on year on year as productivity rose. But what's happened since then is, as productivity has risen, wages have stagnated, and all of that extra wealth has been put in the pockets of the wealthy. Very good for them, but not very good for the success of capitalism. Whereas, of course, in China, where they redistribute, we've got free healthcare and all these other things, no private banking system, you are allowed to set up a private bank, but it's on very, very strict regulation, their economy's growing because they know what to do. Like the Russian nationalised arms industry, far better than BAA systems, much better, much more efficient. That's what you should be doing. And, of course, it didn't matter when they were on the floor, because when we could do it our own way and they couldn't do anything to us. But now, of course, what's happening with the BRICS countries is they're actually getting better at all of this, using the techniques that we used to use back in the day. That's what they're doing. And we're now on the downward slope, and they're on the upward slope.
Judith Brown last week was talking about the decarbonisation industrial complex. What about this surveillance industrial complex? It's the tech surveillance. There's some sort of organisation out there making massive, massive profiles of every person on the planet. That's their object. What Whitney Webb was saying last week is the US Total Information Awareness Program has been, because it was deemed unconstitutional, has just been privatized and given to companies like Palantir.
Well, that's right. That's the way you get round. There's supposed to be some kind of control over this. It just becomes a matter for internal business. You know, we've got our records of our customers.
I suppose,
of course, we have. You know, there's nothing to do with the state.
But at the same time, you've also got political intervention by the spy cops. You know, this has been going on for a long time. We were talking briefly about it earlier, but here is Nicholas Jones, who I interviewed a few months ago, talking about a chap called Seamus Milne, who wrote a book called, I think it was called The Enemy Within, wasn't it, about the miners' strike and the way that the secret services were actually infiltrating the miners.
Seamus has done a lot of research on this, and I've no doubt, knowing the Labour and Industrial Correspondence Group, and knowing, as I have explained, that a number of them, a considerable number of them, worked on newspapers of the right, newspapers that were pretty well closely aligned with the Conservatives. And I have no doubt that this is quite correct, that during times of stress, there would have been these links. And of course, it was a two-way trade. What you're not perhaps understanding is that, yes, there would have been security officers who would have spoken to some of these journalists. And of course, the journalists were getting tip-offs the other way. They were getting exclusive stories. So journalists like myself, I was in the BBC, I assure you, never knowingly spoke to a security officer. We can come back to that in a second, because there is a development there. But if we actually get to the era that we're talking about of you know, things like the miners' strike or the Wapping dispute, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that there might well have been contact. And what struck us, you see, during events like the miners' strike was that often the national newspapers on the right, the supporting papers for Mrs. Thatcher, had high-grade tip-offs about what was happening. I mean, the most spectacular was the Sunday Times scoop about a man who worked for the miners' union called Roger Windsor ending up in Tripoli asking Colonel Gaddafi for money to help with the miners' strike in 1984. Now, I can assure you that none of us knew, but, I mean, how was it that the Sunday Times was in the right place at the right time to get information like that? They knew a lot about what had happened to the miners' money, because during the strike, the miners' own money was sequestrated and seized by the courts. So there was a lot of two-way traffic, I think, and that partly explains what's happened. But look, I've got to bring you straight up to date here, because there are two developments. I am part of an application to MI5 to see whether my phone was ever tapped, to see whether I was ever under surveillance. I've also made an inquiry and tried to become part of an inquiry that's called the Undercover Police Inquiry, which resumes in July. And most significantly of all, this inquiry, they have been looking into those cases where undercover police officers covering the big sort of demonstrations of the 70s and early 80s, you know, like the CND or the various other big protest marches and events, whether they were under surveillance. Now, what happens is that we now know that there were undercover police officers who had romantic affairs, liaisons with activists, and in some cases that led to children being born, and that was why Mrs. Theresa May, when she was Prime Minister, agreed to set up this inquiry into the work of undercover police officers. Well, just to cut to the quick, that inquiry resumes in July, and they are looking at strikes and events and protests from 1983 onwards. And that's led people like me, who covered the miners' strike, we believe our phones were tapped, to ask whether we can become participants in that inquiry in case there is any evidence about what happened during the miners' strike.
Well, it's a bit cheeky, really, isn't it? Because, I mean, this is an industrial dispute. MI5 and Special Branch should be deployed in stopping the KGB and, you know, these massive foreign intelligence services from infiltrating Britain. It's not really their job to even get involved in industrial disputes, surely.
But you've just hit on the very justification which was used by Mrs. Thatcher and the security services. You see, the minute that Arthur Scargill in the miners' strike sought the support of trade unions in the USSR, in the Soviet bloc, Colonel Gaddafi and so on, that then posed a potential threat to the security of the UK. And that was used as a justification for all sorts of surveillance, which we now know took place. So if we can imagine the day when the miners' money is seized, they'd squirreled it away. Arthur Scargill had squirreled it away in a number of banks around Europe. And of course, it was all seized by the sequestrators Price Waterhouse working on tip-offs from the security services because, you know, they'd followed the movement of the money and the people involved. So that's just an illustration of the degree to which there was considered to be a justification. What people like me are concerned about is that, I mean, I at my home used to get and would discuss on the phone aspects of the strike with Arthur Scargill. On one day, I remember giving him a lift. This was soon after the Battle of Orgreave, all the way from North Wales to his flat in the Barbican. And he told me afterwards, he didn't tell me at the time, but when we'd stopped at the service station, the cops had come along and tapped on the window and said, "Mr. Scargill, you're not in your usual car. Are you okay?" So I was being followed by the cops. So I have to sort of say, well, I would quite like to know to what degree was there undercover police, work during the miners' strike affecting journalists? And Seamus Milne has written this sort of great big piece alleging that many of the correspondents were in the pay of the security services or under the influence of the security services. I have every belief that there might well have been some of that cross-fertilization going on, but I've got, as I said, we've got no evidence yet, although we understand it is the case, that journalists in the miners' strike were under police surveillance as well.
This spy cops, I think it's this is the way it's been labelled, the spy cops.
Yep, it is.
Inquiry.
Exactly, you've got it on the net.
It's really a kind of politicisation. They're looking at, for example, amazing stories coming out of that, such as it looks as if the leader of the environmental groups, which were shutting down coal-fired power stations,
yes.
Back
yes.
in the noughties, were actually police. Can you just say something about this sort of difficult position of infiltrating groups and controlling them? Because we don't really know if a group is thoroughly infiltrated, whether it's really a group with its own mind at all, or whether the state has taken control of it.
Well, that's exactly so. Now, I mentioned this man, Roger Windsor. Now, he was the chief executive of the National Union of Mine Workers and had come to the union's attention because he was very good at international union trade union affairs. Now, I mean, there are allegations which Roger Windsor stoutly denies that he too was a plant. So, I mean, these allegations are swirling around. There's no doubt about it if you look at the miners' strike in particular. I mean, I researched a story when it was quite clear that Scargill phones had been tapped because it was all about whether or not he was taking pills during the strike, towards the end of the strike. McGregor asked me, why is Scargill, is he still taking the tablets? Police officers I knew who asked me, is Scargill still taking the tablets? Well, in the end, in the February of 1984, I did stop Arthur Scargill. I asked him about this, and I said, look, I said, I keep getting these suggestions. I've got to ask you, are you still taking the tablets, you see? I mean, it sounded like a joke, didn't it? Well, he said, yes, sir, I am taking some tablets. I'm taking some vitamin pills. But he said, it's very interesting that you should ask me about it, he said, because I had to seek the advice of a couple of alternative doctors. The point is, I'm not eating properly. I do need vitamin supplements, and I did need advice. And he said, look, it's another example of, it sounds innocuous, but I mean, they could only have been teasing journalists to ask the question because of the fact that, they listened into his phone calls and knew that he was taking tablets. I mean, nobody else knew that he was taking a vitamin pill, but you can just see it sounds totally innocuous, Tony.
Yeah, you can imagine.
What it illustrates, I've just explained to you, is this two-way trade, you see. Here, a senior police officer suggested to me, I asked Scargill, are you taking the tablets? Well, why did a senior police officer suggest that to me? You see, and that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about, this cross-fertilization between the police, the security services and journalism. It is a murky world.
Well, it certainly is a murky world, and we heard a lot about this kind of thing through the phone hacking scandal, Martin, too, didn't we? The very, very close relationship that security services have with the London press.
Well, it was the police, wasn't it, that was the news of the world in that particular case. Yes, well, I mean, it's basically journalists, police officers, security agents, military people, we're all in the same game. And in actual fact, everybody knows, if you don't, they're trying to find out what we're doing, we're trying to find out what they're doing, everybody's watching everybody else. It's the same, it's all the same stuff, isn't it?
So there was a really good programme on, I'll put a link up to it, I imagine it's up there on YouTube or something, last week on phone hacking, on the phone hacking scandal, where this is a similar, I mean, we're just staying on surveillance until we get to the break, a couple more clips, but Nick Davis was the journalist that I've always really admired as a brilliant writer. What he used to do was, when there's a bit of a difficult story, a conundrum, he would go and actually move into the area where the story had happened and then write a book about it. So in other words, talk to the locals, which is what good journalists always do. But this clip from that documentary, I think it was made by ITV, it was called The Tabloids on Trial, I think. And the idea really was to get the Leveson inquiry going again, because there's a lot of stuff from that hasn't been really unearthed still. And it starts off with Hugh Grant, who's one of the campaigners against the phone hacking by the News of the World, talking about when his house got burgled.
So, in the case of my flat burglary, yeah, it was quite spectacular in that the whole door had been taken off its hinges. It's a big walk up, like four floors up. And yes, they'd been through the flat and nothing was stolen. They'd been there to get information. And a lot of information about the interior and the contents of my flat appeared in newspapers a couple of days later. And there's never been a burglary before or since.
But back then, Hugh says, even contacting the police brought its own risks.
These people live above the law. And the police, I'm afraid, at least at that stage, were as dangerous as the reporters. If you called the police about anything, I remember my girlfriend getting mugged just around here, if you called them, you were absolutely sure that the first person who would turn up would not be a policeman, it would be a reporter. Because the Met just got straight on the phone to the tabloids, tipped them off.
Most of the more difficult or illegal acts were farmed out to private investigators, PIs, specialising in what was known as the dark arts. And sometimes they had links to the police. Peter, which isn't his real name, was a serving officer, whilst moonlighting as a PI. He says he worked for Mirror Group and News Group newspapers.
We mainly specialised in the surveillance side of things. Anything from accessing voicemails, getting into people's emails, phone tapping.
If you personally couldn't get hold of information, how did you go about finding it? What did you do?
We had a network of subcontractors who could help us with getting any information that we wanted. Some of them were more prevalent in blagging. Some were good at IT stuff. And some were good at phone tapping.
Do you think that the people who commissioned your work knew that the information could only have come from unlawful methods?
It was a bit like the Wild West, really. It was very open. Everything was talked about. I don't think that there were ever a time where anyone would say, you need to be careful about this.
But away from Fleet Street, their victims and the public had no idea. Until, in 2005, a chain of events at the News of the World exposed their unlawful tactics.
The Royal Correspondent of the News of the World, Clive Goodman, is plodding away in the News of the World office, not doing terribly well. There's this private investigator in the background, Glenn Mulcair, who's helping other people to hack voicemail. Goodman hooks up with him and says, come on, help me out here, mate. The mistake that Goodman and Mulcair made was to target the one group of people in this country who have more prestige and more power than Rupert Murdoch and his company, the royal family.
They systematically targeted phone numbers from the royal household, and to some extent, they were successful. Their hacking did bring in exclusives about Prince Harry and William, but the details were so specific they could only have come from one place: voicemails. Buckingham Palace grew suspicious and contacted the police.
In August 2006, Clive Goodman and Glenn Mulcair are arrested. The police seize the private investigators' notebooks containing thousands of names and mobile numbers, but no one else at the News of the World is charged. Within months, Scotland Yard closes the police investigation, only giving their reasons years later.
Our inquiries show that in the vast majority of cases, there was insufficient evidence to show that tapping had actually been achieved.
The pair are convicted in January 2007. Though the paper's editor, Andy Coulson, says he had no idea it had been going on, he resigns and moves on to a new job as director of communications for the then opposition leader, David Cameron.
I believe in giving people a second chance.
In February, the paper's new editor says an internal investigation found it had been a rogue exception carried out by a single reporter in their newsroom.
And the News of the World succeeded at that time at strapping down a cover-up. They were allowed to get away with claiming, nothing to see here, one dodgy reporter, that's it. And they very, very nearly got away with that.
The police didn't act quickly enough. I was deputy editor of the News of the World before the hacking era. Later on, again before the hacking era, I was deputy editor of the Daily Mirror and editor of the Sunday Mirror. People in the industry weren't buying it, or at least most of them weren't, especially anybody with any tabloid experience.
But the scandal was about to evolve beyond celebrity to those caught up in tragedy, prompting public outrage and years of claims, court cases and compensation.
I was contacted by a complete stranger who was in a position to know the whole truth about the phone hacking saga. And he sent me an email and said, here's my mobile phone number, contact me, but whatever you do, don't leave a voicemail message.
So that's Nick Davis there finishing that report from the ITV, I'm pretty sure it was ITV or Channel 4 documentary the other week. Very important, though, isn't it, to look at this? It's called New Tabloids on Trial. And the idea of resurrecting this is because the Leveson inquiry, which came from the phone hacking scandal, hasn't actually been completed. And the present government, Martin, has decided, no, it's not going to be completed. We've decided we're not going to be picking up on any of this.
Well, don't forget that Keir Starmer has been very much in contact with Rupert Murdoch and The Sun, and the Telegraph, not the Telegraph, the Sun certainly half-heartedly endorsed Starmer, and therefore that will be part of the quid pro quo, I presume, that we'll drop all of this and you don't have to worry about it, Rupert.
Yeah, it's all sorts of... I mean, do you remember Squidgygate and Camillagate? I'm trying to think what years. That was around the mid-1990s, I think, wasn't it? 1990... telephone conversation, Squidgygate, also known as Dinagate, but we all knew it at the time as Squidgygate. Conversations between Diana and a close friend, James Gilby, which were published by The Sun. 1992, The Sun publicly revealed the recording's existence in an article entitled Squidgygate, the gate suffix being a reference to Watergate. During the calls, Gilby affectionately called Diana by the names Squidgy and Squidge. But these were actual phone recordings which were published, and the transcripts put in the newspaper, Martin. I mean, this is one step beyond the surveillance. It's actually, you know, recording and publishing people's private phone calls of the royals. And it's interesting, I think, in that documentary, it's saying, well, this has been going on for years, but when they started targeting the royals, then the heat was on them.
Well, yes, but they haven't really changed their spots, have they? Let's face it, I mean, the Tory press is as venal as it's always been, and it still is.
But, I mean, this, look, all I'm trying to say here is that maybe this sort of stuff goes on far, far more. It's just that it always seems to have been the Sun and the News of the World that break these stories. They seem to be closer to the surveillance state than almost anybody else.
Well, that's right. Rupert Murdoch has got very strong political views, and he very much supported the invasion of Iraq, so he's very friendly to Mr. Blair, and also he cultivated relationships with the police. You know, he's a very powerful guy. Yeah, but of course, even he is going to throw up against people who might be a bit more powerful than him. But the thing that really shocked, of course, everybody was the hacking of Millie Dowler's phone, who had been a victim. She'd been murdered, I think, hadn't she? And they hacked her phone because they were just getting so arrogant they thought they could get away with anything.
So you had Squidgygate, as we were just talking about with Diana. Then there was Camillagate with King Charles. It was almost as if there was some kind of competition going on here to hack the royals' phones, not just to hack them, but to record their calls, Martin.
Yes, and just think of all the money that was made by the Sun and the News of the World breaking all these stories about all of the shenanigans going on in the royal family.
I mean, in a way,
best friends with who and who wasn't best friends
with who. Of course, if you look at
very,
it now,
very, very lucrative.
With hindsight, this the leaks about Diana was almost like the divorce playing out on the front page of the Sun.
Well, that's right, and of course, it was very, very good for sales. Yeah. If you want to know, I mean, you know, people like this kind of stuff. It's prurient, but they love it. And of course, it sells newspapers. Advertisers love it. It's a way to make money. And if you know, who's going to stop us?
Well, I'll tell you who is the royals, as they just pointed out in there. Once the royal family, and it seems, doesn't it? The police do take a bit of a back seat on a lot of this stuff, unless it gets somebody who's quite powerful, like, for example, someone who appoints police chiefs, appoints army officers, appoints judges, like the Queen or Prince Charles, as he was now, King Charles. Once it starts getting rather close to their lives, then things start to move.
Well, that's right. I mean, I've had a terrible experience with the Sun years ago. They turned up at... I was working in a school. I was actually doing teacher training in a school in Fulham. And we had, you know, a Christmas show. And the year fours decided that we're going to do, you know, just for a change, we're going to do a Caribbean Christmas. So, yeah, they just... it was about... instead of 12 days of Christmas, there's 5 ripe mangoes. So they changed it. So it was a Caribbean version of the song. And the parents all clapped and politely, and the kids all did their bit. Next morning, in the Sun, there was, you know, parents storm out of politically correct Christmas show. Parents were disgusted when the 12 days of Christmas was changed. Blah, blah. They weren't. Nobody was disgusted. Everybody's perfectly happy with it. No problem whatsoever. But it went all around the country. Well, and then of course, the head teacher complained and said, look, we didn't even know you were there. You just walked in. None of that's true. The boards of governors complained. And of course, they just said, because many people reading that really think that these parents stormed out of this terrible, terrible show in the school in Fulham that I was working in. Of course, absolute lies. Now, if you're small people like that, just being people who have sent their kids to a local school, you've got no comeback whatever. They can just do what they like, and they do.
They do. They certainly do. Of course, our friend of this programme, Kevin Carhill, retired now, used to work at the Sunday Times. He had this to say about the £1,000 a week. Yes, £1,000 a week, folks, that the Murdoch Empire, particularly the News of the World and the Sun, were paying to the police.
In 1990, I told my manager at the Sunday Times that what News International was doing in Parliament was blackmail. It was criminal. And he didn't kind of stop me or anything. He said, well, if you want to run that story here, you get your P45s at lunchtime. And then we both agreed that this, we couldn't go to the police because the News of the World was paying $100,000 a week to the cops. Everybody knew this.
Okay, so how were MPs being bribed then?
Some of them were bribed for stories. Some of them were blackmailed, usually on behalf of the Whip's officers. There was a deal going on. I mean, what use is, if you're a Whip for any party, what use is it knowing that one of your MPs is having an affair on the side or something if you can't threaten the MP with exposure? And this was what was happening non-stop. Because I was in an unusual position. I was working in Parliament for people like, as it happened, Gordon Brown, and various, Michael Meacher and various people. And I could see what the News of the World journalists were doing. They were a criminal team of, what do you call it, blackmailers. Yeah. And every one of them knew it. They were all in on it.
They were all in on it. And it's interesting, I think, 100 grand a week going from News International to the police, the Metropolitan Police. This is coppers taking two salaries. There you've got it from the horse's mouth, someone that was working in Parliament and for Rupert Murdoch at the time. And his manager, his boss at the Sunday Times saying, well, if you want to think about reporting any of this, then you're going to get your P45 at lunchtime.
Well, that's the system of control under which that we and they still live. And Rupert Murdoch is on his last legs now, obviously, but his pernicious empire is still very much part of what goes on, isn't it? You know, politicians are afraid of him and his empire. Starmer went out of his way to be, to get him on side. And he gave an interview to The Sun, of course, and of course people in Liverpool were absolutely appalled. If you go there, people still don't buy The Sun all these years later. If people see you reading it, they get really cross. But Starmer thought it was okay to give an interview to The Sun because, you know, that's what he's got to do if he's going to be, you know, Conservative Prime Minister. So that's what he did. And of course, the Murdoch Empire, because they have supported this new Labour government, they will be expecting favours in return, as will many others.
So, the assassinations in Beirut and Tehran, also the Rockefellers controlling a lot of our politics here in the West, as well as the Olympics after the break.
Listen, all of you people.
Let us pray. We pray to the Lord in his holy temple for peoples and nations, for an end to war in all the world, and for the coming of God's kingdom of justice and peace. Eternal God, in whose perfect kingdom no sword is drawn but the sword of righteousness, and no strength known but the strength of love, so mightily spread abroad your Spirit, that all peoples may be gathered under the banner of the Prince of Peace, as children of one God and Father of all, to whom be dominion and glory, now and forever.
Amen. Amen.
We pray for the Church of God, for John, our bishop, and for this Cathedral and Diocese of Worcester, and in this Three Choirs Week for our friends in Gloucester and Hereford. We pray for Christians throughout the world. Almighty Father, giver of every good and perfect gift, who has made the light of truth to shine in our hearts, help us to walk as children of light in all goodness and righteousness, that we may have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Amen. We pray for all those in any kind of need, especially the victims of this week's violence in Southport. Lord Christ, shine upon all who are in the darkness of suffering or grief, that in your light they may receive hope and courage, and in your presence may find their rest and peace. For your love's sake. Amen.
Amen.
And finally, in this Three Choirs Festival, we give thanks to God for the gift of music. Generous God, Creator Spirit, in the making of music, you have given us a delight for the mind and a solace for the heart. By the harmonies of your grace, resolve the discord of our lives, that we may sound forth your praise in all we do and all we are. We make this prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. We pray for one another and for ourselves as we say together, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all, evermore. Amen.
Officer Landeros for doing such wrong, and Officer Gonzalez for just going along. Death to all them pressers, I kill them with a song. The police, they don't ever get the peace. The police, all they ever bring is grief. The police, the brutality increase. The police, will this madness ever cease? The police, they don't ever keep the peace.
on your name. Your cover is a copper, but you're criminal just the same. Shame, 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 shame upon your name. Your cover is a copper, but you're criminal just the same. They won't give the people no respect. They won't treat them like human beings. The corruption still goes unchecked. But the people have seen, seen, seen. Shame, 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 shame upon your name. Your cover is a copper, but your criminal just the same. Shame, 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 shame upon your name. Your cover is a copper, but your criminal just the same.
Del Santo, not Dan Del Shannon, as I incorrectly, stupidly and moronically said last week. And there's a bit of a website around this guy. He was in Texas, a singer in Texas, and obviously other parts of the US too, played around the US in the 1970s, late 70s, 1980s mainly. But then he disappeared, and I think he's vanished, basically, to South America somewhere. And there were allegations about drugs. Some I don't know. I've no idea what the truth or whatever. Anyway, someone and a few people in the US have decided to try and resurrect some of his music and his, to make it available to people like you and I. So that's rather wonderful. And that one's called The Police, or is it De Police? Something like that, by Dan Del Santo. Before that, we had The Seekers, from 1964, with Open the Pearly Gates, that's right. And the other one was from Worcester Cathedral, Prayers This Week on the Choral Evensong live from Worcester Cathedral. It's a terrific, as they go, the Choral Evensongs are pretty good generally, but it was a cracker this week from Worcester Cathedral because they had three choirs in from Herefordshire, Worcestershire and Gloucestershire all singing together live on Radio 3. That's the sort of thing that the devil hates and I love. So more power to the BBC Radio 3's elbow. And when people stop talking about defunding the BBC, then you're also talking about defunding things like that, which nobody else does. None of the private, you know, Murdoch empires or anybody does for some ridiculous reason. And in fact, I would suggest maybe the church itself should have its own broadcasting thing to get on with stuff like that. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. As promised, the big assassination. This is in a week of assassinations again, Martin, wasn't it? So Netanyahu flies to the States, goes and has a little birthday party with his son down in Florida, tells Trump what he has to do if he's not going to assassinate him, and flies back to, with a pat on the back from the deep state, and to assassinate a few foreign leaders in capitals around, like, for example, Beirut and Tehran.
Well, yeah. And of course, the killing in Gaza continues relendlessly. But we, you know, we've all moved on from that now. It's the Olympics that we're all supposed to be caring about.
Well, we'll be talking about the Olympics at the end. Russell Brand has had quite some interesting stuff to say about that, and I mean, it'd be interesting to get your comments as well on. But this is the, what we're talking about actually is an assassination program. Really, it's what I would call a decapitation strategy, isn't it? The idea is you take out the leaders, and I'm not sure if it actually really has very much effect. I mean, you yourself have said about Russia, if you kill Putin, there's countless other people of a similar mindset who want to protect Russia in a similar way to Putin, and they will continue to do so. But so by demonizing him, it was a different story with, say, Saddam Hussein, and also, of course, with Colonel Gaddafi, because they had relatively fragile structures around them. But that's not the case, really, in Iran, and it's not the case in certainly in Lebanon or in Russia. So why are the Israelis pursuing? I'm assuming it was the Israelis that killed this guy in Tehran. The main Hamas leader. What is the strategy around it? He was their chief negotiator for the release of the hostages, after all.
Well, it kills off any possibility of a ceasefire and the hostages being released. As the Al-Thani, the Prime Minister of Qatar, was saying, well, you can't really negotiate in good faith if you're going to kill the people you're negotiating with. Incidentally, of course, if Western leaders agree that it's okay for Hania to be assassinated like this, as I'm sure Biden and
Starmer
will eventually agree, well, you know, he was a bad guy and we can't really criticise this, because of course the Iranians are now going to retaliate, like possibly like they did last time, so the RAF will be going out there to protect the Israelis who've carried out this attack. So we obviously agree with this kind of attack if we go out and do that. I would just say, well, that means that you, Sir Keir, you're an elected leader of your country. Hania used to be the Prime Minister of Palestine. He's dead now. Now, remind me again, what job do you do? Oh, you're a prime minister. So you're a legitimate target then?
I mean,
No, I'm not a legitimate. He's a legitimate target. I'm not. Really?
Do you think it would actually, this is in a way a tactic, the decapitation strategy that they're using against foreign leaders that they're at war with, at least some of them. They're not quite at war with Hezbollah and Lebanon yet, but it seems they would like to be. Well, look, I mean, it's a limited war, should we say.
Mm-hmm.
A bit like NATO and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So is the idea that the reason they're doing this is because that's what they're most afraid of?
They're doing it because it closes off the possibility. I mean, don't forget, Netanyahu is in a reckless gambling scenario mood. I mean, if he was assassinated, that might make a difference, because he's a particularly egregious felon. So you could argue, if he was to be assassinated, you might get somebody more sensible in charge. But in any case, the Israelis seem to take the view that they're allowed to kill whoever they like, but you're not allowed to do anything to us, because that's anti-Semitic. But I think ultimately, you know, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. I'm quite sure that plenty of young lads and lasses in Gaza would be quite happy to take the job of killing Netanyahu if they were given it. And, you know, there we go.
So why aren't they?
Because they can't that easily. So what the Israelis are doing, we can do this, but you can't do it to us. Well, that's debatable, isn't it? Netanyahu went to the US, but if he tried to go anywhere else, there's a possibility that he would be arrested.
Well, we're moving into a world, Martin, we're moving into a world where our elites and our leaders, whereas back in, say, I don't know, the 50s and 60s, you know, they could kind of chit-chat and walk around amongst the public. They can't do that anymore, can they?
No, well, I mean, this whole thing has been developing over many, many years. I mean, in the 50s and the 60s, neither the US nor the USSR wanted to go down the road of assassinating the other side's leaders. Because once you do that, there's no turning back, yeah? And everybody's stuck with it. Now, in actual fact, these kind of things have always gone on, you know. Salvador Allende could have been arrested, but he wasn't. He was shot dead. And this is, you know, and this happens all over the place all the time. But I think there's a tendency for Western politicians to think that's the sort of thing that can happen to other people, like Ismail Haniyeh, but not us. You know, we're not legitimate.
Yeah, it's they're othering them, aren't they? Ismail Haniyeh is the guy. He was killed by a bomb, apparently, that Israeli intelligence planted at an official guest residence in Tehran about 2 months ago.
Two theories about this: it was either a missile or a bomb. I've seen both. Is this likely?
I mean, the Israelis would neither confirm nor deny that they did this assassination. Is it Israel or is it the United States that's done this?
Well, I bet you the CIA knew about it.
They work hand in hand, surely.
Of course they do.
What about the Brits?
Well, they're all in it together. That's why it's only the United States and Britain that's bombing Yemen at the moment. Nobody else wants to do that.
I mean, most
apart
people,
from the Israelis, the Brits, and the Americans are bombing Yemen.
When this nobody explosion occurred and this Haniyeh was killed, most people were assuming it's very difficult to tell straight away when it comes out of the blue whether it was a bomb planted beforehand or whether the missile strike.
Well,
came
the Iranians will be investigating all of this.
Of course, if it was a missile, isn't it likely that the US satellites and, you know, US intelligence would have been involved in doing that targeting? Maybe, you know, tracking mobile phones or phones of his bodyguards, this sort of thing?
Yes, they claimed that they had no prior warning, but the Iranians aren't necessarily going to believe that, are they?
Who had no prior warning?
The US intelligence services claimed they had prior warning of this attack.
And it might be that this story about the bomb being planted 2 months ago is just to divert away from the fact that the US intelligence has been involved in this targeting.
Well, that may be so, Tony. We're all still trying to process. And no doubt the Iranian authorities are doing exactly that as we speak.
And
lots of people in Iran, I understand, from reading the internet, are very unhappy because it shows that they knew exactly where he was.
We can assume, can't we?
You know, somebody should have made sure that he wasn't in the same place as he was last time. Can I understand that's where he was.
We can assume that, because he has been out of Qatar many times, in fact.
Well, he lives openly.
It's just this time.
He lives openly
that he was in
Qatar.
But they won't attack him in Qatar. That's the problem.
No,
as soon as he comes out of Qatar, then they can kill him. But he's been to Tehran many times. He's been to other countries many times.
Well,
this time, they killed him this time. Number one, it's because their war seems to be coming to a bit of a dead end in Gaza, that that Hamas is even stronger now than it was when they started, and that's got rid of one of their objectives. The other objective is about freeing the hostages. Well, they're killing them instead, so that's not working either. And so this is a way of just sort of trying to take the war on in some way. And also, it seems pretty obvious to me that Netanyahu has got the green light in the United States for doing this when he was over there.
That's right. He will have chatted to the relevant people, nudges and winks. And of course, the point is that they may just say to them, don't tell us what you're going to do, and then we won't know, will we? That's the way you deal with that, isn't it?
For example, this is one of the reasons that you have these Bilderberg conferences, because these people do have to meet face to face. They can't have these sorts of conversations over encrypted anything, because they know that the Russians, the Chinese, and everybody else maybe will be able to record it, hear it, and broadcast it in the future.
Well, I mean, it's fairly obvious to everybody who's observing this, who's got any knowledge about it, that the Israelis, the Americans, and the British are the main culprits in this whole thing. Other countries, you know, Spain, for example, are trying to create distance between themselves and what's going on. Britain, no. No, because it's part of our duty to support the United States and the rules-based order.
This is how the...
Which involves assassination.
This is how the BBC announced the killing of the chief negotiator, the number two of two leaders of Hamas in Tehran this week.
Are we on the verge of a wider regional confrontation between Israel and the string of Iranian-backed groups that operate in the area? Well, two killings in the past 24 hours have revived those fears again. As we came on air last night, Israel had claimed it had killed a senior commander from the Lebanese militia, Hezbollah, in a strike on a southern suburb of Beirut. Israel holds him responsible for Saturday's missile strike that killed 12 children and teenagers from the Druze community in the Golan Heights. Well, today Hezbollah confirmed that the body of its commander, Fuad Shukr, had indeed been found. Before that, in the early hours of this morning, there was news of another even more audacious attack. Audacious because of the target's identity and his location. That is Iranian state television reporting what it described as the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, the political leader of Hamas, along with his bodyguards. Haniyeh was killed in Tehran just hours after he had attended the inauguration of the new Iranian president. Well, Israel has not claimed responsibility for that attack. Today, though, Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, promised to avenge his death, promising harsh punishment. The Palestinian journalist, Khada Ouda, is in Gaza and described how people there have reacted to the news of Ismail Haniyeh's death.
You know, Ismail Haniyeh...
Ismail Haniyeh is from a shanty camp in Gaza City, and I talk with people who say he was a peaceful man and that they used to see him in the streets walking. He used to greet people. They told me he used to talk to them as a normal man, away from the military factions or the military side. He was considered like a peaceful and moderate leader of Hamas.
Well, when he addressed the nation this evening, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did not refer to the attack in Tehran. He focused instead on the killing of the senior Hezbollah commander in the Lebanese capital.
Anyone who slaughters our children, anyone who murders our citizens, anyone who hit our country, his blood be on his own head. Citizens of Israel, challenging days lie ahead. Since the strike in Beirut, there are threats sounding from all directions. We are prepared for any scenario, and we will stand united and determined against any threat. Israel will exact a heavy price for any aggression against us from any arena.
So that's the World Tonight reporting that, Martin. Quite a good roundup. But the one thing that annoys me so much about the BBC, the way they do these sorts of things, is using the word audacious, which means daring, adventurous, spirited, imaginative. That's an act of war?
Yeah, well, the other thing they said when they killed, they're talking about the assassination in Beirut, Hezbollah have said that their guy was killed, but they also killed a woman and two children.
Not
mentioned at all.
No.
Yeah. So, you know, the Israeli...
Nations shall speak peace unto nation. That's carved on the broadcasting house there.
Yes, well, the other thing, of course, is that there's a lot of suspicions about this so-called attack, Hezbollah attack in the Golan Heights. Hezbollah never fires stuff into the Golan Heights, or very rarely, and they would never be targeting a Druze community in the Golan Heights. Walid Jumbat, who's the leader of the Progressive Socialist
Party
in Lebanon.
He's still alive, actually.
Yeah, he's still alive. And he was saying that the Druze community are absolutely in line with, you know, we support the Palestinian struggle. We don't believe that they want to be part of Syria. But the Golan is part of Syria, but it's been annexed by the Israelis. They took it in 1973 and 1967 and have been keeping it ever since. And they're moving their people in, which you're not supposed to do. And they've also claimed the oil rights.
There was
an
instant denial by Hezbollah about having anything to do with that. Is it possible that the Netanyahu has killed people that his country is occupying deliberately in order to try and do a false flag there?
Do you think Mossad would do something like that?
Ah, by way of deception, challenge to war.
Yeah, but I mean, if you killed 12 Israeli children, that might be, you know, they might draw the line at that. But 12 Druze children...
Ah, well, Jonathan Cook made a very good article about this, good old Jonathan Cook, explaining that, oh yes, all these kids have been killed, and even if, which he doubts, the Israelis, the Hezbollah did it, what about all the children that the Israelis have been killing, and also deliberately targeting children?
Yes.
Children on the beach, children playing football, this sort of thing. That's all forgotten in this reporting. So the BBC are basically public relations for the Israeli Defence Force.
That's right, and the way they do it.
And the genocide.
The way they do it is by sounding reasonable, but but leaving out vital bits of information. As I mentioned earlier, the fact that a woman and two children were killed, and lots of other people were injured in the assassination
of the
Scot. So
this decapitation strategy, it's not new, is it? I can remember...
No, they've been doing it for years.
I can remember chatting with a former policeman. He was in the... He was in the army. Serving in the army in 1945 and 1946 over in Palestine. And he said that there were obviously straight away problems with the Zionist terrorists, and the British forces who were trying to occupy, well, were occupying the place, were doing everything they could to try to get, this is another world, by the way, of course, this was at the end of the Second World War, and the last thing they wanted was to get involved in another war. They just wanted to try and sort this one out. And they were getting the representatives of the Arab communities, in Palestine and the Jews together. And as soon as, one of the things he said was, as soon as the Arabs put someone forward to try and negotiate with the British for some sort of peace with the Zionist community in Jerusalem, in Tel Aviv, etc., that person would be assassinated by the Haganah or by the Stern Gang or by the Jewish terrorists.
Yeah, they've always gone in for what you might call, you know, decapitation strikes and so on, but they just kill people at random as well. I mean, you know, they've got a track record of doing this.
This is making sure that there is anybody that is in the frame to negotiate peace is killed.
That's Hania was the person that they were negotiating with about a ceasefire and a deal. He was the top guy. He was the one that they needed to talk to, and they were talking to him indirectly. So by killing him, they kill off any hope of a negotiated solution. What they're playing for is a war in Lebanon, which the United States will then join in against Iran, and Britain will join in with the United States. Other European countries will not, but I think there's going to be a bit of resistance in Britain to our getting involved in joining in a war for Israel, which has gone out of its way to provoke such a war.
It is
why should we get involved in that to help you
one
out?
One of the
here?
Things which
we shouldn't,
which the BBC completely ignores, is the fact that it's actually really a tiny number of people pushing this war. Tiny number.
Yes, but they're very powerful. And, you know, Rupert Murdoch, for example, we were talking about him earlier, he'll be one of them.
Is it? Are we
Sheldon
almost,
Adelson's
are we
widow, Miriam Adelson, very powerful
here
woman.
About a cult, about a tiny little clique of people who know that what they're doing is wrong, but they also know that they might end up in bars if they break silence. So they stick together, this lot.
Well, they do, but it's because this is a real problem and has been for years, a particular problem for the Palestinians, obviously. But, I mean, you know, the West has basically indulged the state of Israel for many, many years for all kinds of reasons which we could go into, but listeners will know what
we will go into in a bit of depth, I think, the sort of thing that the BBC should do but they don't do and other broadcasters should do and the background to all of this. In fact, they used to do it. I remember Tim Llewellyn in the 1990s, early 1990s, with the first Gulf War around that time, with loads and loads of in-depth coverage about the background to it, the history to it, the different communities. Now what we get is nothing. And what we do also get is statements like this from the British ambassador to the UN Security Council.
The UK is resolute in our commitment to Israel's security. We support Israel's right to defend itself in the face of such aggression, in line with international humanitarian law. Third, since October 7 last year, we have seen the terrible toll on Israelis, Palestinians, and many others in the region. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is truly appalling, with nearly 40,000 Palestinians killed. The impact of this devastation is particularly acute for women and children. The attempts by Iran and their proxies to use the suffering of those in Gaza as justification for further violence is perverse, and we reject them entirely. We support all ongoing efforts to bring stability to the region and an end to the suffering. We reiterate our call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza to protect civilians, get all the hostages out, get more aid in, and open a pathway towards long-term peace. This will require the parties to commit to a renewed peace process resulting in a two-state solution with a safe and secure Israel alongside a viable and sovereign Palestinian state. I thank you.
So that's paid for out of our taxpayers' money, Barbara Woodward. She's not talking, and she didn't talk in her speech there about the idea that it might be wrong to enact a war against another country. She's really talking about this as a sort of equal struggle, but certainly making sure she makes it clear that the United Kingdom backs Israel in this struggle. So all sorts of, almost every step she's putting herself on the wrong side of history and completely out of step with British public opinion.
And international public opinion. And, you know, South Africans have definitely, precipitated a huge, movement across the world against what's going on, but the British are, you know, the British government, Labour government, as it now is, are determined not to listen to any of that. And,
she used to be the ambassador to China, by the way.
Yes, okay, well, they get moved around, these people, don't they?
This and in a conversation, the Queen apparently said that Chinese officials were very rude to their ambassador, referring to Ms. Woodward.
Gosh, can you imagine the Chinese? Why would the Chinese want to be rude to her? I mean, they've just had all the Palestinian factions in Beijing when Wang Li, their foreign minister, has got them all to agree that we're going to have a unity government to take over Palestine once the Israelis have been defeated. And, of course, they support the Palestinians' right to armed resistance, as well they might.
She was
Chinese
included
communists
in the Queen's birthday honours in 2016 and also made a Dame Commander of the Most Distinguished Order of St. Michael and St. George for services to you. China relations. Well, I wonder if there's a special order we're not being told about, which people get appointed to when they're trying to start a third world war.
Well, the British position there is utterly hypocritical, as she's put it forward. She says we want a ceasefire. If you're going to have a ceasefire, you've got to make the Israelis accept one.
You've got to stop supplying weapons.
Yes, yeah, stop
to
supplying
Israel,
weapons
to genocidists.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, and yes, you've got to cooperate with arrest warrants and things
yes,
like
that's
that.
That's right. Yep. Maybe we're going to have to, and I don't agree with the two, in Israel itself, in the Knesset, they had a massive vote not that long ago, about 10 days ago, that they will never accept a Palestinian state, ever. They've made their position absolutely clear. So there's no point British ambassadors going, we're going to have a two-state solution.
Oh,
the
pointless.
Israelis have ruled that out.
Yep.
So there isn't going to be a two-state solution. There's going to be a one-state solution. And it's either going to be called Israel or it's going to be called
Maybe
Palestine.
Maybe that two-state solution could be Israel and a rather powerful Chinese-backed UN force in the region.
Well, that's a bit of fantasy, Tony. That's not going to happen. What's going to happen is that Israel itself is
China may arrive on the scene at some point.
They are going to arrive, but they're going to arrive with pots of money to rebuild after the war's over.
Well, that's BlackRock, I think, isn't it?
Well, it's also...
Is it BlackRock or China? Maybe...
No, China. China. No, BlackRock wants to take over Ukraine, but unfortunately, the best bits of the Ukraine, they're not going to have.
Probably find they're involved in Gaza, too,
well,
destroying
that
and rebuilding.
They are, of course they are, but of course the Israelis are overplaying their hands militarily here massively.
We hear a lot about a lot about Russia, but not enough about China. And so Dave sent me this link with the Chinese statement to the UN Security Council, the emergency meeting on the assassination by the Israelis or the United States or both. Hamas joint leader in Tehran this week.
The Gaza conflict has been going on for nearly 300 days, resulting in nearly 40,000 deaths and an unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe. Over 2 months ago, the Council adopted Resolution 2735. As of now, however, ceasefire negotiations have yet to yield any progress. While the spillover effects of this conflict are increasingly visible, with the tensions between Lebanon and Israel, between Syria and Israel, and in the Red Sea sounding the alarm frequently, the Middle East situation is hanging by a thread, much to the concern of the international community. Given the severity of the situation, the parties concerned must heed international calls for a ceasefire and cessation of fighting. They must implement Council resolutions fully, actively coordinate with and support international good offices, and take tangible actions to push for de-escalation and the restoration of peace and tranquility in the region. They must not act single-mindedly and repeatedly take provocative and risky actions to stoke steady escalations.
So that's the Chinese ambassador to the UN Security Council giving their point of view at this emergency meeting this week, Martin. Actually, they're a bit boring, but they've got this kind of legalistic thing where they're saying, hang on, we've had these resolutions. They haven't even been implemented yet. And it's quite nice the way she actually names them, says the dates of when the resolutions are, and saying, well, hang on a minute, we've made these resolutions here that everyone's agreed on. Nobody vetoed these, and yet nothing's happened about the ceasefire at all.
Well, the whole world knows that what's blocking a ceasefire is that the Israelis don't want a ceasefire. They made it clear by carrying out these assassinations.
Well, the United States has been contemptuous, really, isn't it? And Britain, of these resolutions. They're both party to, all party to,
right,
the UN,
well,
Security,
I mean,
Council.
Ultimately, of course, the legal position, don't forget the ICJ ruled all of Israel's occupation of post-1967 lands as illegal. Yeah. Now, that's not the position of the British or the Americans, but that is the legal position as it's emerging. Also, they're being accused of genocide. Hania himself was under, the ICC had got a warrant out for his arrest. But, of course, what the Israelis have shot that fox by killing him. So the only people left on that arrest warrant now are them. Because they've killed the people that...
The point about that there won't be a two-state solution. Anyone that says there is a fool, like the British ambassador there to the UN Security Council. And one of our crew, I suppose you could call him that, people that do what we do in a similar sort of way, we think of him as part of the team, really, is a guy called Patrick Henningsen. He does stuff for TNT Radio, which is really kind of a TV channel too, but he also does this thing called the Sunday Wire, 21st Century Wire, does a terrific job. Just got to say, love him to bits, because I see him as a steady kind of voice of reason out there, and it's nice that it's not just there's other people doing similar stuff to us. Anyway, he had this to say this week about Israel Palestine and how the whole idea of sovereignty has been stripped away from Palestine completely deliberately by the Israeli Defense Force and by the Brits and the Americans backing them. So that's why there won't be any kind of two-state solution.
Over the years, it's become evident to everybody that there is no viable two-state solution, because realistically, Israel will never give up control over the roads, the security roads, effectively a web of, Bantustans. They're not going to allow an airport, any kind of standing military, maybe not even a working port, maybe not even porous borders. It will still be, they'll still want control over the security of the Palestinian territories. So there is no state. A sort of collection of patches of land, Gaza and bits and pieces of the West Bank and the Jordan Valley, that's not a state. And it's not sovereign if it doesn't have control over its water, electricity, its airspace, its telecommunications. It's not able to defend itself. It's not a state. So it just becomes a sort of, an occupied, and everything but name, an occupied territory. But more people are, even the hard left, are now talking about a one-state solution. They're saying, well, the future is a one-state solution. We're seeing more talk of this over time. I think it's a generational thing. It's the same in Ireland. The unification of Ireland, out of the question 20 years ago, because that generation, there's too much bad blood. There's just too many things attached to the past. As the boomers cycle out of the story and Gen Z comes in, they don't have that natural animus or dislike or, vengeful ideas between the north and the south of Ireland. They're more amicable to a united Ireland. I think the same in the Middle East. I think over time, more people will see the benefit of a one-state solution. That's just my personal view, because the other one is a non-starter. A two-state solution is a non-starter. What shape that takes, what it's called, that's up for the people in the region to decide. What Palestinians want is up for, really, is for Palestinians to decide, not the United States. They tried that before.
But is it really up to the Palestinians?
It's not, but it should be. Mm-hmm. And so then that brings us to the other key point. What are our values in the West? Do we believe in self-determination? Do we believe in sovereignty? Do we believe in equal rights? Mm-hmm. Do we believe in one state, everybody treated equally under the law with a Bill of Rights and maybe a constitution? We certainly espouse that in America. We export that vociferously, and we do it at the barrel of a gun sometimes, even though that's not exactly what we're exporting. Mm-hmm. But we certainly talk about this, that those are our first principles. So if we wouldn't accept anything less in America, why would we accept something like an apartheid system, or worse, a violent, oppressive apartheid system? Mm-hmm. in the Middle East from our greatest ally. Why is that okay for the region, but not okay here? Certainly we should be advocating what we have in the Middle East, whatever shape that takes. But the current situation, what we're supporting there, which is an ethno-nationalist exclusionary state of Israel, and then this sort of reservation system for the native Palestinian population, you could argue that this even still exists here in America, but not to get into the Native American conversation, that's an interesting debate. But so what's good for the goose isn't good for the gander in that respect. And that's, that level of hypocrisy is becoming now recognized by a lot of people in the world. And again, this undercuts the U.S. legitimacy in terms of its rhetoric and its soft power. Its message is now being undercut by its own policies and actions.
So that's Patrick Henningsen, 21st Century Wire. I like the way he sort of slowly, he doesn't do what we do, Martin, where we kind of rapidly rant away about these things, but he's taking a very sort of slow view of the entire situation over there. And really the hypocrisy, what he's describing, I love it, is this whole idea of a cliquey elite in the West, in the Anglo-Zionist Empire, some very powerful, but a very small number of people being slowly isolated by their own hypocrisy.
Well, that's true, but they're still very powerful, and they've got a lot of resources. So, you know, just because there's more of us and less of them, that's part of the problem, isn't it? They dominate by dominating the levers of power. I think what's going to happen, in my view, of course, it's hard to say what's going to happen, because of course, if this escalates out of control, we're all just going to end up dead. And that will be as a result of the Israelis being totally uncontrollable. And they've got nuclear weapons. We all know they've got nuclear weapons.
A lot of this is surely to do with fear, isn't it? Instilling fear into the population, the fear of war, the fear of mass slaughter, the fear of starvation. And the idea is to sort of float the whole Gaza situation out there for people saying, look what we've done to them. We could do this to you.
Well, that's right. But the point is, if you're going to make people fearful, the best way to make them fearful isn't just through psychological manipulation. It's to hurt them and hurt them badly so that they really do get fearful. Yeah, that is what you do. So, that, you know, there's an illusion that it's all just about mind control. Mind control is part of warfare. Of course it is. But the real control is fire control, is make these people scared, kill them, frighten them. And you frighten them by killing them and hurting them.
One of the other ways you can frighten them is by taking away their homes, taking away their food, taking away their electricity. And that's another thing I rather liked about what Patrick was saying there, is he's saying a country's not sovereign if they don't control their water, their electricity, these sorts of basic services. Well, we don't. A lot of our basic services are controlled by, say, Chinese or US multinationals. Britain doesn't exist as a state anymore in many ways.
Well, that was the policy from the 1980s onwards. We don't have an industrial policy. Anybody can come in and buy anything they want in this country as long as they've got enough money, and they've just been allowed to do it. Thames Water is all, you know, who owns Thames Water? It's hard to work out, actually, because we don't know who owns it. We used to own it, but now we don't know who owns it.
Yeah, and whoever it is just jacking up the price because they're price fixing. Anyway, Netanyahu's end game. Why don't we have a listen to an Israeli Jew talking about this? A guy called Gideon Levy is talking about, what he thinks is Netanyahu's end game in doing these kinds of, basically pursuing this decapitation strategy.
9 months in the war, there were always almost no refusals, no refusals. Everyone who was called went to serve. I don't say if it's good or bad, but it's a matter of fact. There were some gray refuseniks who did it under the radar, but it's not in meaningful figures. Unlikely other wars in which in this stage you would expect already a massive public movement of refuseniks, it didn't happen here. Which means that at least for the short future, don't expect the soldiers not to show up. They will continue to serve and continue to pay in their lives. Not that I can fully understand it, because most of them understand the lack of logic of this war, the lack of any sense of this war. Most of them are supposed to understand the crimes that we are committing. which cannot lead any country to a good place, which will affect one day the regime in Israel, and we see it by now. But here and there you see cracks, like we saw the other day when those fascist activists penetrated into Sde Teiman, the concentration camp of the army in the south, and to another army bases where the few rapist soldiers were held. This was a very warning sign, but don't count on it. I mean, don't expect the Israeli army to fall apart within the few months or weeks. If they will be called, they will come. That's the nature, that's the spirit of Israel, for the good and for the bad. It's not that I'm very proud or happy about it, but that's a matter of fact.
Last week, Benjamin Netanyahu was in the United States speaking to the U.S. Congress. He received what can only be described as a hero's welcome on that floor by a lot of the majority of Republicans, Congress people, but also a significant number of Democrats as well. How was that seen from Israel? How was that perceived?
So I'll tell you how it was seen by me. For me, it was the most shameful hour of the American Congress. I think Capitol Hill never witnessed such a shameful session like the session with Netanyahu. Cheering to a criminal of war, standing ovation, 55 standing ovation for what? For someone who is responsible for mass killing in Gaza of tens of thousands? For someone who is responsible for mass killing of children and women, for whom did they cheer? This was so shameful. And I believe that most of the Israelis were not misled by those scenes. I mean, on one hand, obviously, the right-wingers were very proud. And there is a reason for them to be proud. There's no other statesman who was invited to appear in front of the Congress four times. No European prime minister could do it. No Asian leader could get to it. The question is not that they are in this case. The question is the stupidity of the American legislators. And I have no other way but to use this word stupidity, because they were cheering to hollow cliches. There was not one sentence that Netanyahu said which was connected to reality, and there was not one sentence he said which he meant, nothing. And they were cheering like puppets. God, if I would have been American, I would be so ashamed on this day.
And following that reception, the imagery of it, do you think it gave Netanyahu a kind of moral or political strength to be able to come back and effectively carry out these two political assassinations in the way that he did?
Hard to tell. He heard some things, at least from Kamala Harris, but he counts on Donald Trump. And maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. I don't know. Nobody knows who will win the elections. It's also a question if Kamala Harris is just talking like President Biden, or she really means business, and that's still to be proved. We are sick and tired of all kind of talkings, threats, advisors to Israel, and then supplying more weapons and ammunition to Israel. I mean, from this we had enough. From American politicians who say the right things and their heart was in the right place, who is more than the former president, Barack Obama, who spoke so nicely, who spoke about peace, about Islam, about the Palestinians as the black slavery of the United States, and supplied Israel with weapons, with vetoes, with everything Israel asked for.
So that's Gideon Levy speaking about Netanyahu's visit, also making some excellent points about this idea, Kamala Harris, she didn't go to this speech by Netanyahu. But what he's saying there is that this is posturing. Actually, she does support what Netanyahu is doing. And the idea is that she thinks she can get some votes by not going into Congress. That doesn't mean to say she doesn't support the constant supply of weapons to the Israelis.
Well, she's been the vice president while all of this has been going on. And, you know, she's...
I'll put a full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, by the way. Gideon Levy is an Israeli journalist. We don't hear anything. We don't really see him on Channel 4 News, do we? We don't see him on the BBC enough.
No, well, I read his stuff. I'm aware of who he is. He's, you know, he's one of the good Israelis. As they talk about the good Germans, he's one of the good Israelis. Well, you know, Kamala Harris has an opportunity. If she was her own boss, she could say, right, I'm going to ring the changes here. I'm going to be the presidential candidate for the Democratic Party. That's what's lined up here. And there's a reason for you to vote for me, because I'm not going to go to war in the Middle East. Trump is about to go to war in the Middle East and create a chaos which could lead to everybody being killed. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to tell the Israelis, you've got to stop. We need a ceasefire now. And as soon as I'm the president, I'm going to cut off your arms supply unless you do as I say.
But she's not saying that.
No. She's not going to do that. No. She could, though, and that would probably win her the election.
Yes, you might.
It's you know, that is an absolutely clear strategy.
Come on, Kamala. You know what to do. Do the right thing. What about that other incident he talks about, Gideon there, the far-right protesters storming a building for the right to rape? Unbelievable scenes, says the Canary, but a lot of other people have reported this. Far-right Israelis protested the arrest of IDF soldiers for the alleged gang rape and abuse of a Palestinian detainee. The protesters stormed Israel's SDE, I don't know how you pronounce that, Telman detention facility, where Israeli police had arrested 9 soldiers. Well, first of all, how on earth do they get into this detention facility? Maybe some of them work there and open the doors for them. But for the right to rape...
Well, yes, because, you know, we're at war with these animals. And, you know, in the Knesset, an Arab member of the Knesset said to one of the ministers, you know, is it okay to rape people with metal rods? And he said, yes, if they are Hamas terrorists, of course, anything's justified. So
the protests included several reserved soldiers, but also far-right government minister Arnikai Elahu and parliamentarian Zvi Sukkot of the Religious Zionist Movement. They are actually parliamentarians. They're, you know, they're Israeli MPs involved in this.
Well,
right.
I understand.
We have the right to rape Palestinians.
Well, and it's not just a one-off either. There's loads of evidence coming out of what was happening in that particular detention facility, where, you know, people are basically being killed and tortured. You know, that's what's going on. It's just like the Gestapo or anything like that. It's going on. And, of course, it should stop, but it's not going to stop. And we're going to carry on supporting it. And the RAF, no doubt, will fly from Akrotiri to bomb Lebanon if we get involved.
Hezbollah is a proscribed terrorist organisation, didn't you know?
Well, that's right. Hezbollah and Hamas are both proscribed by Britain. It's actually relatively recent.
Can't we just reverse those decisions, folks? These are national organisations. They're not terrorist organisations. And by proscribing them in Britain, what we're doing is we're just simply giving a pat on the back to the genocidalists.
That's right. Well, we could also say, if we were going to be consistent, we're not going to recognise the Israeli government because they're terrorists. And it doesn't matter how many votes you get, you're terrorists, we're not going to talk to you until you elect somebody sensible.
Anyway, so there's been some good, I think it's only just out this week, actually. Thank you, whoever sent me a copy of this. It's a film for about, I think it's about an hour and a half, the film is. We're just going to have a listen now to a four-minute clip from it. And it's about the Yinon Plan and Christopher Bolin. It's called, if you want to look it up now, I'll put a link up to it, the full version on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's called Israel's Second 9/11, How Zionism Conquered JFK, America and Palestine. And it's been put together by Matthew Tower. So let's have a listen to a clip from that now, which I think features Christopher Bolin.
If we had known there were no weapons of mass destruction, there would have been no war.
Now, what's going on here is that an Israeli plan known as the Yinon Plan, which was articulated in 1982, is being put into effect so that countries are being balkanized. That is, they're being broken up into ethnic statelets. You're causing friction between the various ethnic groups, breaking them up into ethnic statelets. That's the name of the game in Syria. That's what they did in Iraq. That's what's happened in Libya, etc. This is the Israeli plan to dominate the Middle East by breaking up the large Arab states and breaking up their armies and breaking the countries into pieces like Yugoslavia. There will be no competition for Israel. and Israel will have hegemony over in the entire region.
If you take out Saddam's regime, I guarantee you that it will have enormous positive reverberations on the region.
Oded Yinon's 1982 Zionist plan for the Middle East is in large part taking shape. Is this coincidence? Was Yinon a psychic? We in the West are victims of a long-held agenda, not of our making, and without a doubt not in our interest. We're waging war for another entity, for another nation, for another interest that's not ours. And we're paying for it. Our sons and daughters are fighting it. And this is the partition of Palestine. When it happened in 1947, Menachem Begin rejected it.
We had several other people in the country, even among the Jews, the Zionists particularly, who were against anything that was to be done if they couldn't have the whole of Palestine and everything handed to them on a silver plate so they wouldn't have to do anything. It couldn't be done. We had to take it in small doses. You can't move 5 or 6 million people out of a country and fill it up with 5 or 6 million more and expect both sets of them to be pleased.
He said, Jerusalem was and will forever be our capital. And Eretz Israel will be restored to the people of Israel. All of it and forever. This is to give you an idea what Eretz Israel means. It means the land of Israel. And according to people like Menachem Begin, it extends from the Nile River to the Euphrates. And this area right here is the Kurdish area, which happens to be occupied by the United States. This is all Syria right here. This is where the United States is occupying one-third of Syria. These are the various ethnic communities, religions, factions in Iraq and Syria. And from the Yinon plan, Yinon said the dissolution of Syria and Iraq is Israel's primary target on the Eastern Front. The dissolution of the military power of these states serves as the primary short-term target.
We had all sorts of objections to everything that was done. Something had to be done. We went ahead and done it, and had it done, and now it's working out. Eventually, I think we'll have them all satisfied. But it's going to take a great deal of time yet to get the job done.
This is exactly what we did. When we went to Iraq, first in 1991 and then again in 2003, we destroyed the Iraqi military. If you remember, one of the first things that happened is when we got into Iraq, we disbanded the entire military, sent everybody home, no more jobs, no entitlements, nothing. So the military went away. And in Syria, we've been trying to do the same thing for the last 7 years. Now, this is another break area here. Periwinkle is the area of the Kurds. And this area is where most of the oil is. And the United States and Israel are supporting the Kurdish independence. This area here in northern Iraq and this part of northern Syria. And in pursuing that, the largest holder of the reserves in this Kurdistan area of Iraq is a company called Genel Energy, which is a Rothschild company. So they're going after the strategic assets. And these two cities, Mosul and Raqqa, were targets of the American anti-terrorist attacks last summer, which destroyed those cities, destroyed them. Here's Mosul in June of 2017, the great mosque of al-Nuri, destroyed in the Battle of Mosul. The Americans, we put our artillery around the cities and just pounded them for months. And that has a price. Here's Syria, the other city in Raqqa, in Syria. October 2017, at least half the city is totally destroyed. We said we were fighting ISIS, but under the pretext of fighting ISIS, we destroyed the cities. ISIS is the target, and they put that target wherever they want, and then destroy everything around the target.
From the Jordan River to the Middle East, that's all ours. It was promised to us.
Well, I mean, you know, the level of depravity of what's going on is extraordinary. He mentioned there the Kurdish area of northern Iraq, of northern Iraq, but southern Syria, the Kurds aren't in fact the majority in the area where they've taken over. There's actually Arab tribes there who are not happy about being ruled by the Kurds. And of course, that's exactly the area which the SDF is controlling with American military support. And they're stealing the oil. It's being exported out of Syria and then via Iraq to be sold to the Israelis.
Yeah, he's talking there, isn't he? Chris Bolin in that. And I'll put, as I said, a link up to the full interview or full documentary on our show page and the video of it at thisweek.org.uk. The sort of thing that we should be seeing if we lived in a rational, sane and unbiased world. We'd be seeing that on the TV tonight, but we're not seeing it because those documentary makers are apparently beyond the pale when allowed to know about these sorts of things. The same kind of reason, of course, why this show has had its problems with various venues, and also why Press TV the Iranian English language channel and RT, the Russian English language channel, have been banned because they probably would show you such things. But taking another step back from all of this, that's quite good, I think, from a time point of view. But this is also come to me this week by somebody sent me this. Thank you. It's called About the Rockefeller Funding and how they apparently control the game. It's by a chap called Jacob Nordangard, quite not sure if I pronounced that right, but he's done a whole book about the Rockefellers' influence in controlling politics in America through groups like the Trilateral Commission, which Keir Starmer joined in order to undermine Jeremy Corbyn successfully, and the Bilderbergers.
Now we come to the policy life cycle. Recognition of a problem. What was the problem that the Rockefeller brothers talked about? One of the brothers, Lawrence, he was into conservation efforts and natural resources. We saw problems with too many people. And how can we better use our resources? And they said we need some kind of global planning of the resources. They supported world government ideas. And the ideology was Malthusian. That meant that money, food supplies can't meet the demand of a growing population. And the modern environmental discourse was kind of born with those involved together with Lawrence in the Conservation Foundation, founded in 1948, with Fairfield Osborne Jr. as president and chairman. he wrote a book called Our Plundered Planet. And the conclusions were later echoed in reports by the Club of Rome. But this spurred a debate in the 50s about population. The other brother, one of the other brothers, John D. Rockefeller III, he was very much into to population and population control. If you have too many people in the world, this is a problem. How shall we manage this? Population Council that he founded, they started planning for a global plan for population control to reduce fertility and also ideas of relocate populations in the world.
So that is Jacob Nordangard. I'll put a full link up to his book, Rockefeller Funding and Controlling the Game, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Basically, what's going on after the Second World War, the Rockefellers, actually in some cases before the Second World War, they seem to be taking up this British idea of the empire being able to control the world, as you know, people like Milner and Rhodes were suggesting around about the time of the turn of the century. The Americans are taking this whole thing very seriously. It's like, well, if we take over the British Empire, we will then control the world. But the Rockefellers are actually getting involved in things like, well, we can actually start managing the world's population. We're so powerful. And not only that, they're also setting up these institutions like the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderberg Group in order to make sure that their people, and only their people, get into top political positions in the West.
Well, that's obviously what's true. That's what's going on. But of course, it's not necessarily all going entirely their own way. They've been very destructive in what they're trying to do. But it's not necessarily going to work. It's not necessarily going to work out well either. But, you know, I think a lot of what they're talking about is frankly fantasy. There is actually the population is slowing down. Population growth is slowing down virtually everywhere in the world, apart from in sub-Saharan Africa. But then sub-Saharan Africa has put some of the poor, they're the most exploited part of the world system. And therefore it's very difficult for them to control their population. They haven't got the resources. You know, people breed because they breed and they haven't really got the powers. As people get more prosperous, they do in fact have less children.
Yes, that's right. Well, this seems to be the obvious solution. Increase people's living standards. And then your population problem solved.
Well, it's not solved, but it is.
It is. And actually what we've got is we've got perfectly enough land and resources to feed everybody. It's just that there is a massive amount of hoarding and price fixing going on, which means that some people starve, and that those resources the earth provides are not being distributed properly.
Well, that's right. So, you know, the wealthy get really freaked out, you know, the Rockefellers and so on. There's just too many people, and the problem is there's too many rich people. If we could get rid of you, we could manage.
Well, maybe. Yeah? What they're thinking, really, is there's too many poor people, and we'd rather manage the world without them.
Well, that's what they do. That is clearly what's seems underlying all of this. Going back to, the Milner and Rhodes, you mentioned them, they were racist. They thought that, you know, the white racists should rule the world and everybody else should just, you know, knuckle under or get out of the way or do as they were told. And that hasn't changed much. We're seeing it now in Israel. That's exactly the attitude. We are actually civilized. So you see what Netanyahu was going to? It's a fight between civilization and barbarism. And he's right.
Yeah, but he's the barbarist.
He's the barbarian.
Yeah, that's right. He's the barbarist. And I'm not talking about haircuts either. But anyway, so there are a couple of stories before we close. The US has declared Venezuela's opposition candidate the winner.
Well, I thought Juan Guaido was the winner. He's the president of Venezuela, isn't he? I mean, he was declared the president of Venezuela years ago. Why isn't he the president? Maybe Yanukovych.
Can we say about this? For anybody who's been watching this, it's so obvious what's going on. Maduro is just not the person they wanted to win. He's won. And so they're just trying to make trouble. Now, this is election interference by the US, not by Russia, by the United States. And Venezuela happens to be sitting on quite a lot of oil. AMERICOM, which is the US military command, is trying to take over Venezuela.
Well, that's right. The Electoral Commission still hasn't released the full results because, as part of what looks like a colour revolution game, the electronic voting machines which they use, and there's a paper ballot and an electronic voting machine. This is why they've had, because they've had all these rows over the years. So it's a very, very rigid system. You know, you have to leave a mark. With your thumbprint, you have to show ID. All this, you know, but it was hacked on the night of the election. Yeah. So that they haven't been able,
It must be Russians.
Oh, yes, the Russians obviously hacked it. Yeah, that's right. I mean, Maduro, you know, who's the inheritor of Chavez's political legacy, there are more poor people in Venezuela than rich people. And, you know, the left have been winning elections in Venezuela since the 1980s, even though they've been under sanctions, which have made life miserable for many, many people. I mean, they've just put them under sanctions, no matter what they do. And, of course, what they're trying to say to them is, if you vote the right way, we'll lift these sanctions off you. But in actual fact, in Venezuela, there's quite a strong revolutionary tradition. That's where Simon Bolivar came from. He's from Caracas. And they won't be able to bump them out, partly because the army are loyal to the regime. They tried some years ago to get the army to carry out a coup. So Maduro said to the generals, "We'll just pretend to go along with it." So they all went along with it, and the Americans said, "Oh, well, we're going to have a coup now. We're going to have a coup. Are you ready for the coup? Are you ready for the coup?" And as soon as they got it all out, they got all the information. The generals said, "In actual fact, we're just kidding. There isn't going to be a coup." And the Americans were like, "Oh." Because they just thought they could have a coup, but not in Bolivar.
Okay, and also, what about this prisoner swap that we've had yesterday? One of the biggest ones since the Cold War. United States and Russia have conducted a prisoner swap that has freed Wall Street reporter Evan Gershowitz and former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan. He was arrested, Gershowitz, in March 2023 on charges of espionage, rejected by the U.S. government and the Wall Street Journal, of course. In July, he was convicted to serve a 16-year prison sentence But the US and Russia were quietly negotiating this prisoner swap. Alexei Navalny, though, of course, has died, so he won't be being swapped.
No, and Assange has been released, so he can't be involved in this either. It is interesting that despite all of the rowing and arguing, and we're all going to war and saber
rattling. Hang on, sorry, Martin, you know, Assange was going to Australia, not to Russia.
No, I'm pointing out that if he was still in prison, he could have been part of this prisoner swap, couldn't he? The Russians could have said, well, release Assange and we'll release somebody that you want released, you know. If you want Navalny, we want Assange.
Well, maybe that was one of the reasons he was released when he was.
Well, maybe.
So that he wouldn't have been left in jail after all of this. It's possible.
I mean, it is interesting that they can actually do these deals. In theory, they're not speaking to each other at all. Putin is an evil, evil man, and he must be assassinated like Hania. But we can do a deal with him about this.
Biden accused, by the way, Biden did accuse Putin of killing Navalny, but it was later revealed that US intelligence agencies didn't actually believe this was the case.
That's right.
Ukrainian intelligence said he died of a blood clot.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't very
healthy. This has been part of it, hasn't it? Well, you know, it's a shame that Navalny couldn't be released. But actually, what happens is, when Navalny died, there was loads and loads of stuff about, oh, Russia have killed him. A tiny little line in the news saying, oh, no, it was a blood clot, actually.
Well, that's right. And, of course, what most people will think, well, that, you know, they've got the vision in their mind of Russia as this terrible totalitarian. It's, you know, they've watched James Bond films. They know what
Russia
is.
Do you know
Russia's
what?
Like,
I think
yeah.
It's almost like, it's whenever Tony Russia Blair says like something, that. People now think a lot of people, when the Russians are blamed for something, people just shrug their shoulders and say, yeah, right. Don't they?
Well, I think in Russia itself, which has
in
become
in this part of the world, I think.
Well, yes, because the level of propaganda, people go, the reason that people voted for Putin in Russia is because propaganda, they're just brainwashed. So you're not brainwashed, they are, but you're not.
No, he's a dictator.
Well, what's interesting to me about Russia is that because they've come to democracy very late, through a massive struggle, huge effort over many generations, they actually value it. Mm. Whereas in the West, we've got so used to having it, we think, that we don't value it at all. And we don't really understand what it is.
I mean, most of our history is monarchies and things. Actually, the same in Russia.
The same. Yes, all of these things have been a struggle in every society.
Finally, Russell Brand on the Olympics opening ceremony, which was going on just as we closed this show last week.
Here's how not to apologise by saying sort of, well, I don't know what's wrong with you. They must have something wrong with you. That's not an apology.
Clearly, there was never an intention to show disrespect to any religious group. On the contrary, I think that Thomas Jolie really tried to really intend to celebrate community tolerance. That was his word yesterday. And looking at the result of the polls that we shared, we believe that this ambition was achieved. If people have taken any offense, we are, of course, really, really sorry.
It was a ceremony like no other, and those are games like no other. I think that our hosts, it's easy for me to say, and we should all be grateful and thankful, they have put together a vision for these games, which is unprecedented.
Also, note the Coca-Cola. It's the titty milk of Satan just there at the Olympics. But they can't even do their apology without drink Coke. Drink it. Drink down its caffeinated, sugary, admittedly delicious, poisonous, filthy, diabetes-causing goodness. Like the whole thing is simply a platform of corporatism and perhaps something far, far worse.
It's an incredible vision for a Games. We're trying to showcase that in the best possible way.
What's amazing is if you actually read about the Last Supper, it's an opportunity to say that we can live forever in grace if we are willing to sacrifice ourselves and be sacrificed for a higher principle, that we need not endeavor through merit to achieve greatness, for the supreme sacrifice has redeemed us all, and through gratitude we ought live in kindness. If we did live in the kindness suggested in particular at the Last Supper, so casually mocked in that festival of godlessness and commerce and corporatism that's meant to be about celebrating sport and by their own reckoning diversity is the acceptance and love of other people, the acceptance that there is no tribunal but God that can judge others, that we are here to serve and love one another. All of it's taken care of in the Last Supper, as well as in Mark, at least, Christ saying, it's going to be crazy. You lot are going to deny me. You're going to betray me. You're going to live in extraordinary ways. You're going to lose touch with your principles. There's so much prophecy in the Gospels. There is so much wisdom in the teaching of Christ, but it is in his death and resurrection that what we are offered is a different way of living. We are offered a way of living in awakened enlightenment and love and service. And I will say this again, because this is what I think is the main point. If you actually follow Jesus and surrender to Jesus, you don't need a culture telling you to treat people fairly and with love and to not condemn or judge them, because that is Christ's key point. Love one another. In fact, when asked to distill the commandments down to a single one, or two, I suppose, love God with all your heart and love thy neighbor. And there is no loophole or condition or limited liability when it comes to love thy neighbor.
So that's Russell Brand there talking about the Olympic ceremony and the Da Vinci pastiche that was... What did you think, Martin, about this?
Well, I don't know if you've been following this, Tony, but the
of
people...
Of course I have.
The people who did it, the people who made the video, are saying this is actually the Greek gods. It's actually
it's a bacchanalia,
It's a bacchanalia based on... And it's because it's the Olympics. It's about Greek stuff. It's not about Christianity. Loads of people out there
but it's used,
in the Olympics...
they've used the... they've used this Da Vinci...
No, they haven't. They've used the Da Vinci painting to frame. That's
what they've done is they've repainted Da Vinci with their own characters
Not a Da Vinci painting, it's another painting that came from the 17th century. And they pointed out, in actual fact, this is supposed to be a copy of this painting.
It doesn't matter that they're sticking two fingers up at God,
No, it's the Olympic Games, it's about the Greek gods, yeah? That's what it's about, Greek gods, because it's the Olympic Games. It's not the Christian
and it's
Games.
The triumph, it's the triumph of brawn over brains. That's what the Olympics is.
Well, we don't... If you don't want the Olympics at all, Tony...
I'm not saying I don't want it.
It doesn't matter
all
what
I'm saying
think,
is...
We don't need the Olympics, we don't need any of it.
This is their event. And there's been a few awful things. Like that rapist,
It's not a Russian event, is it? Because they weren't invited.
The Dutch rapist taking part, these transgender guys punching in the boxing ring and knocking out women.
Oh, well.
I mean, this is the way the Olympics is going. Quite obviously, it is more of a bacchanalia than it is a Last Supper. We've got a nice poem from Patrizia Aprilenza this week, from a couple of weeks ago. It says, Tony is here and there every week. TNT Radio, his views oft will seek. Patrick the H, Henningsen, the smooth cat, invites Tony Gosling to chew on the fat. As questions are asked, watch Tony begin, unload his vast knowledge, ever on a whim. Back at headquarters, Martin Summers is there. Top of the heap, mastermind, au contraire. Hats off to you all, but especially Dave B. On tables or stairway, his sound knowledge we see. Bravo to you three who make up the show, not the BCFM News, to the place we all go, to learn all the ropes, to dig up the dirt on those with no scruples in our country have hurt. Gratitude to you all and for all that you do in bringing us truth with an angle on views. Thanks, Patrizia. God bless you and God bless the listeners. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and sound engineer Dave Pazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram if you dare. Do please send me interviews and story tips, and particularly these documentaries. I'm really enjoying those. Actually nice to sit and watch them instead of watching the boring old rubbishy propaganda television. The Psycho in the Corner. There's a lot of other stuff out there you can watch, especially if you've got a smart TV. Not that I'm encouraging people to do it. You can get an MP4, download those, and just watch it on an ordinary TV. But those will be on the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast for this show, the full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. Please subscribe to my free weekly newsletter by emailing me your email address, and I'll pop you on the list. If you can afford it, do donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the Eastone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk. Stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton. Warwickshire, RadioSoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex, and live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. Don't get sucked into the zero trust agenda and don't let those satanic banksters get you down.
I think I've seen you somewhere. I remember you were with that man they took away. I recognize your face.
You've got the wrong man, lady. Well, I don't know him, and I wasn't where he was tonight. Never near the place.
That's strange, for I'm sure I saw you with him.
You were right by his side, and yet you denied.
I tell you, I was never ever with him.
But I saw you too. Not just like you.
I don't know him.
Peter, don't you know what you have said? You've gone and cut him dead.
I had to do it, don't you see? Or else they'd go for me.
It's what he told us you would do. I wonder how he knew.
So we've got a long table, which you see in the Last Supper. We've got people all arranged around it facing us. We have a central figure, not with a halo, but something that's not a million miles away from a halo over their head. And then we've got people standing either side of the central character, sort of blending in each to other, bending their shoulders, sorry, their necks on each other's shoulders. You don't see the Last Supper at all?
Not at all. In fact, considering that this is, no, like have a listen here for a second.
Sure.
Considering the fact that this is an Olympic game, which was from ancient Greece, this is, and the Paris Olympic Committee have already said this, this is a depiction of a Greek bacchanalia. Yeah. The figure that you see on the table is Dionysus.
They've also apologized.
They all, but you know what? They also tried to explain it before, but the fact that everybody doesn't want to listen, because we live in a world where everybody doesn't want to listen. When they form their own opinions, that's it. They don't want to hear any reason. They don't want to hear any excuses.
You honestly don't think that long table with everyone sitting one particular side of it, arranged that way. I hear what you're saying about the fact that we've got a bit bacchanalian orgy going on, but you see no reference whatsoever to that to the Last Supper, Da Vinci's Last Supper.
Turning round and round and round.
about 15 minutes.